In Birmingham, and the man accused of her murder repeatedly disrupted his first court hearing. I'm LBC's George Ike with the latest.
Plus, Prince William speaking openly to Brazilian TV host Luciano Huck about being honest with his children about his wife Kate's diagnosis of cancer.
We choose to communicate a lot more with our children. Now, that has its good things and its bad things. Sometimes you feel you're oversharing with the children, you probably shouldn't. But most of the time, hiding stuff from them doesn't work.
And on this day of remembrance, what do young people make of those wearing poppies? Do they understand the significance? And in a related story, St George's flags create no-go zones for NHS staff, we are told. Those stories and more follow the 7 o'clock news on LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 7 o'clock, Donald Trump says the BBC must retract false and defamatory statements made about him or face a $1 billion lawsuit. Two of the organisation's most senior bosses have stepped down after claims clips of the US president were selectively edited. Former BBC foreign correspondent Sir Max Hastings told LBC he is concerned about the future of the broadcaster.
Donald Trump is the archetypal destroyer. And in a way, he's symbolic of an awful lot of stuff that's going on in the world. And again, we should be asking ourselves, I think, are we or are we not a better society with this or that institution, regardless of its failings? And gosh, it's difficult to keep any sense of balance that all the time we are being driven to greater and greater depths of extremism.
Donald Trump has given the organisation until Friday to respond to his demands. There's a warning the UK's counter-terrorism strategy is no longer keeping the country safe. An independent commission's found the definition of terrorism is too broad and is not fit for purpose. It also found 90% of people referred to the Prevent programme are turned away because they have no obvious ideology. Nearly 3,000 businesses have been raided in a month in a bid to clean up Britain's high streets. The National Crime Agency targeted stores including barbers, vape shops and mini-marts to try to tackle money laundering. More than 900 people were arrested and £10.7 million was seized. The Home Office says it started proceedings to deport the woman found guilty of harassing the parents of Madeleine McCann. 24-year-old Julia Vondelt, who's from Poland, was given a six-month prison sentence. LBC's George Ike has the details.
Julia Vondelt's been told she'll be deported after being found guilty of harassing Kate and Jerry McCann. The judge said her behaviour was now defined as criminal and that the couple had every right not to engage with her. She claimed she might be the missing girl Madeleine McCann for the last 3 years.
And retailers saw a subdued October as consumers held off on spending before Black Friday. New figures from the British Retail Consortium show total sales in the UK increased by 1.6% year on year. Food sales saw good growth, but that was mostly driven by higher prices. In the city, the FTSE 100 will reopen at 97.87 after closing up 105 points yesterday. The pound buys $1.32 and a euro 14. LBC weather raining across Wales, Northern Ireland and Northern England this morning. Brighter in Scotland with highs of 16 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Lottie Morley.
Club card accepted.
Feel the power to lower prices with Tesco Club Card. Get a box of McVitie's Victoria chocolate biscuits, now £3.50, down from £5. Celebrating 30 years of rewards with Tesco Club Card. Tesco, every little helps.
McVitie's Victoria biscuits, 490 grams, majority of larger stores, ends 11th of November. Club Card wrap required.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Ferrari at breakfast.
Good morning. 3 minutes after seven, Tuesday, November the 11th. Pay up or put up? Put up an apology or pay up $1 billion, and the BBC has until Friday. I'll be asking you, if you were in the hot seat, which decision would you make? In other news, the strongest indication yet, Chancellor Rachel Reeves suggesting the two-child cap on benefits could be lifted, speaking in an undoctored interview with the BBC.
I don't think that it's right that a child is penalised because they are in a bigger family through no fault of their own, and so we will take action on child poverty.
You remember the one-in, one-out deal, one huge fiasco announced by Sir Keir Starmer in July?
I'm pleased to announce our agreement today. Migrants arriving via small boat will be detained and returned to France in short order.
It started in August. We've got the latest numbers. This is a second one in, one out. Effectively treats the channel like a P&O ferry and has returned to the country. Coping with the most devastating news, Prince William on Kate's cancer battle. We told the children everything, the good and the bad. If you've had to tell a loved one, particularly your children, that you, your husband, your wife, a grandparent has cancer, how did you do it? Plus, on this day of national significance, what do younger people make of wearing a poppy? Is there a very real possibility that one day might simply fade away? Helen Hoddenott, LBC's reporter, has been out on the streets speaking with young adults in London.
Are young people wearing poppies nowadays? And do they know what they represent? I'm LBC's Helen Hoddenott out on the streets of London to find out.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Call 0345 6060973. Text 84850. Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
We'll come to the extraordinary development from Washington, from the United States in a moment. But let's take you through yesterday's events chronologically. As we tell you, journalistically is normally the easiest and the best way to deal with these matters. We heard from the outgoing CEO of BBC News, head of news, Deborah Turness, doorstepped by the BBC on her way to work at the BBC. And she used the opportunity to stress there is no institutional bias there.
I would like to say it has been the privilege of my career to serve as the CEO of BBC News and to work with our brilliant team of journalists. I stepped down over the weekend because the buck stops with me. But I'd like to make one thing very clear. BBC News is not institutionally biased. That's why it's the world's most trusted news provider.
Why did you fail to deal with the mistakes that were made?
And see my teams. Thank you so much.
Right, we're going now.
Do you think the journalists are corrupt, Mike? Of course our journalists aren't corrupt. Our journalists are hard-working people who strive for impartiality, and I will stand by their journalism.
Is there institutional bias at the BBC?
There is no institutional bias. Mistakes are made, but there's no institutional bias.
Later, it was the turn of the BBC's chairman, Samir Shah, who issued an apology for what he called an error of judgment over the editing of that clip of a speech by US President Donald Trump in the Panorama documentary. He gave an interview to the BBC's media editor, Katie Razzle, who's having tremendous, I have to say, covering this particularly well, almost as well as Gordon Rayner, who broke the story. He explained why he was saying sorry.
The apologising is for the way the team edited President Trump's speech to his supporters on January the 6th. We have received communication from President Trump and his people, and we are at the moment considering how to reply to him.
Has he said that he's going to be suing the BBC?
I do not know that yet, but he's a litigious fellow, so we should be prepared for all outcomes.
He is indeed a litigious fellow, and now I can tell you that, as you will have already heard on LBC bulletins, President Trump has threatened to sue the BBC for $1 billion over a, quote, doctored speech, and they have until Friday to retract or pay up. Well, you'll hear from the journalist who broke the story in a moment. First, let's go to Will Hutton, columnist for The Observer, also was the paper's editor for a period of time not that long ago, and joins me now. Good to have you on, Mr. Hutton. Do you agree that the BBC failed with that Panorama documentary? Good morning.
Good morning. Yes. I mean, there's no question that the edit was, I think, beyond really an error of judgment. It was very bad. And there should have been a more immediate apology.
As Trump asked, that apology should be forthcoming now?
Yes. I think Samir Shah is likely to build on what he's already told the Culture and Media Committee at the Houses of Commons. But I mean, the bigger question is, was it such an egregious error that it was worth two resignations? And that's the proportionality of it all has, I think, got wildly out of control. And I'm not sure, certainly Samir Shah didn't want him to resign. And as far as I understand it, Mr. Gibb, the alleged man at the core of this coup probably didn't want him to go either. So this crisis is engulfing the BBC, and it has the disproportionality of it, I think, is what allows people like me. I mean, I'm a believer in public broadcasting.
But, Mr. Hutton, it's not just this, is it? There's, if you look at the stories run by the Telegraph last week, we see an LGBTQ desk that decides not to do certain stories because they don't fit with the agenda. We see BBC Arabic's coverage of the Middle East. 522 times a contributor is used who called the Jews devils. They have to offer apologies roughly at the rate of 2 a week, and I've not even mentioned Glastonbury. It's not all down to President Trump, Mr. Hutton, is it?
I'm uneasy about that question, Nick. I mean, I'm not, it's a big, big organization. I'm not sure.
But all the stories I track back, all track back to the news department,
yeah,
Will.
I know.
I've not gone into Greg Wallace's baking or anything.
No, I mean, we've actually seen the Gaza documentary, which Channel 4 chose to run, public service broadcaster. I mean, I think the heart of this is, do you start with kind of, it's so kind of broke, it's got to go and be dismantled, and or do you want to fix it? And I want to fix it.
That's how would you fix it? If it is to be fixed, how is it to be fixed, Will?
Well, first of all, I think that it remains, and although kind of Turner said it yesterday, it remains the most trusted news organization in the country. I mean, it's above any newspaper, and that it retains that. And when there are big moments in national life, we all turn to it. That remains the case. And then you have
lastly, for you and me, Will, yes, but for our children or our grandchildren, do you honestly see that level of trust? You and I, you maybe have got, I don't know, 2 years older than me, I have no idea, but we grew up absolutely around the BBC. I don't know that now, Will. Come on, let's be honest with each other. Kids don't turn to it the same way.
I think if the BBC was to go down, it would be a phenomenal loss. It's not just news and current affairs. It's traitors, it's match of the day. It's strictly, it's the whole damn thing. And it would be a kind of cornerstone of our national life that actually does cornerstone it. And actually, in a sense, the kind of furore is because that's recognized. I mean, its enemies, and there are many, don't want it around because it is a cornerstone of our national life. And it does try to represent those values, those Reithian values of kind of, trying to inform, educate, entertain.
Indeed. Well, I must leave it there, Will. Thank you as ever. Will Hutton, columnist of The Observer. You served as the paper's editor as well. Just to make it plain, I do not want to see the BBC dismantled in full, but the size of Reform and Review, the like of which has never been seen before, would be my vote. Let's turn to Gordon Rayner. I mentioned he's the journalist who broke that story, associate editor of the Daily Telegraph, behind those scoops. Okay, same first question to you. What should the BBC do now vis-a-vis President Trump's demands? Morning to you.
Yeah, morning, Nick. Well, I mean, of course he should apologise to President Trump. I do not understand why he's dithering. They've already said that they got this wrong. They've already apologised for the fact that they doctored that speech. Why is he saying that they're considering what to do regarding Trump's demands? They just need to apologise to the man. They've done him a terrible disservice. And I'm afraid it's indicative of the way that the BBC has responded to this entire crisis. It was the same last week when I first put that story to them about Trump. They hoped that it would just go away if they said more or less nothing about it. They spent a week saying almost nothing. It's only when they're forced into a corner that they actually start, realising what they need to do. And let's not forget, Sami Yashar knew about this Panorama documentary in January, and he did nothing about it then either. He is a man who is just dithering and delaying again.
What of these suggestions that there's some right-wing cabal that is trying to bring down the BBC? Are you going to now confess to being a member of that shady group, Gordon?
Well, I'm certainly not, and I don't believe such a thing exists, Nick. I'm sure you don't either.
I don't.
I think people confuse people who want the BBC to get back to doing what it's meant to do with people who think the BBC shouldn't exist. Like you were just saying there. I grew up with the BBC as well. I've got great affection for the BBC. I've always been very proud of what the BBC has represented, especially for Britain around the world. I'm currently in America. I was driving behind a car earlier today, which had a number plate which said, "Doctor Who, my other car is a TARDIS." That was an American car. And I thought, isn't that great that, you know, that's the sort of way that, you know, Britain, it projects itself around the world. And but I'm afraid it's you know, it's losing its way.
Lastly, where does this story go next? Do we all eyes on the chairman and the decision by Friday, would you suggest, Gordon?
In the immediate future, yes, but in the longer term, obviously they need to pick a new director general or indeed change that role. A lot of people think that role is too big for one person, but if they stick with the DG role, they need someone who has got the spine to actually enforce the rules that Tim Davies said he was going to enforce when he got the job 5 years ago. He said all the right things, as you'll remember, Nick. Mm. He said he was going to, you know, make impartiality the, you know, front and center. He said that BBC people wouldn't be able to express their personal views on social media, but then he didn't enforce those rules. And until they can find someone who's prepared to, you know, crack heads together, maybe sack people when they get out of line rather than just sort of nodding along and doing nothing, then I'm afraid this is going to happen over and over again.
Enjoyed our conversation. Have a nice day, as they all say around you in the United States. Gordon Rayner, associate editor of the Daily Telegraph, he broke that story. Your call's coming in and we'll come to you. David Seamus, give you your views. It's a really simple one. This is very, very simple. Do you say sorry or do you pay $1 billion? Will sorry be the hardest word? In other news,
a woman's died after being stabbed in the neck in Birmingham, and the man accused of her murder repeatedly disrupted his first court hearing. I'm LBC's George Ike with the latest.
7:15 now, LBC News headlines, and Lottie Morley.
Donald Trump is threatening to sue the BBC for $1 billion for the way they edited one of his speeches. There are warnings the UK's counter-terrorism strategy is no longer keeping the country safe, and 8 people have been killed after a car exploded near Red Fort in Delhi. LBC weather, raining across Wales and Northern Ireland and Northern England this morning, brighter in Scotland with highs of 16.
LBC Travel, I'm Joanne Webb. On the trains, Great Western Railway are running a reduced service between Paddington and Reading. It's all because of a signal failure. It means that Heathrow Express services are disrupted and there are severe delays on the Elizabeth line between West Drayton and Reading. Gatwick Express, Thames Link and Southern services are all delayed via Purley, also after a signal failure. On the roads, there are severe delays on the western stretch of the M25 clockwise to junction 16 at the M40, and that was after an accident. Also on the M25, there are clockwise queues in Hertfordshire to junction 24 at Potter's Bar after an accident. And on the A21, the Tunbridge Bypass, the southbound exit slip road to the A26 is closed for emergency repair works.
This is LBC.
Build your own package with TUI. Let's go. City break or a beach escape. Lovely. Fly from your local airport.
Taxi's here.
Handy. Any day of the week. Ideal. On a TUI flight or a partner airline.
This is your captain speaking.
Nice. How many nights? 3? 5? 14? Perfect. More options, more choice. All wrapped up with a TUI smile. TUI. Live happy. Atoll and Abtra protected. Booking T's and C's apply.
Call Nick Ferrari now. 0345 6060 973. LBC.
Let's hear from the Chancellor, Geoffrey.
From the Chancellor, Nigel. Chancellor John.
Norman.
Kenneth.
Gordon.
Alistair.
George.
Philip.
Sajid.
Rishi.
Nadine.
Kwasi.
Jeremy.
And now Rachel. Another year, another budget. Over the past 40 years, we've seen it all. Our experts will continue to filter through the noise and uncertainty, helping you make the most of your tax allowances. Hargreaves Lansdown, helping Britain invest through it all. Capital at risk. Tax rules applying can change.
Step aboard the legend of the Titanic, London's award-winning exhibition devoted to the world's most famous ocean liner at Dock X Canada Water. Walk her decks, explore her cabins, discover her secrets. With 360-degree projections, VR, an interactive metaverse, artifacts and more. Book your tickets today at legendoftitanic.com.
A Thames Link train is a place where you can just switch off. Where you have the chance to scroll your feeds as you roll past fields. Or simply relax with a podcast, playlist or power nap. Go with your flow and save with advanced tickets at thameslinkrailway.com. Terms apply.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Call 0345 6060 973.
It's 19 minutes after 7, coming to your calls in just a moment. And this is front page news across the board. Well, sorry, almost across the board. There's a couple of papers in there. Go with it. As the BBC still struggles to get a grip on how to handle this crisis, there's the Daily Mail. Trump tells BBC, grovel, or I'll sue you for £1 billion. The Daily Telegraph, remember, they broke the story. Trump to sue BBC for £1 billion. And there's the Times. BBC is told, say sorry, or Trump will sue for £1 billion. The other powerful front page story, in fact, I think it is the only one. Yes, credit to them, the Daily Mirror, it has it on the front page. But they go with the story that we told the kids everything. Prince William has revealed he and Kate were honest with their children about her, their mother's cancer diagnosis. And we're looking at that in more detail. If you've ever had to have that conversation. Oh, and I remember my dad. Oh, that's going to be a tough one. I remember my dad telling me, God, Dad died 43 years ago. I still remember it. Awful. Let's move on. The OBC app, quite rightly, going with the Donald Trump story. Trump threatens to sue BBC for $1 billion. Let's pick one other. There's nothing else that's extraordinary. No, here we go. Oh, something called I'm a Celebrity is taking place. Oh, an interesting look at list of stars that are going there, as revealed by the Daily Mirror. We might keep an eye on that. Just before I come to your call, David, I want to share with you, the Times newspaper has got in and around the newsrooms of the BBC. They've spoken with John Simpson, the world editor. As Richard Littlejohn brilliantly points out, what do you do for a job? I edit the world. Yeah, of course you do, John. Simpson says, Tim Davey was one of the best DGs the BBC has had. Deborah Tennesse was a brilliant head of news. Only the BBC's enemies could possibly be glad that they've resigned. Well, do I have to go through all the stories again, then? All coming tracking back to the news department. The BBC Arabic, which, by the way, was run by Jonathan Munro, who is now in line to be head of the BBC, the news division, that is. Mr. Munro was responsible for the Cliff Richard fiasco when he put a helicopter live and was reprimanded for that. And also, he rehired Martin Bashir, the disgraced journalist who did the die. Can they not find anyone else over there? Have you not heard of recruitment agencies? We're just trying to get some fresh blood in. The fact that Simpson is now so blinkered just shows how they are. They cannot believe that they can put out stories that are totally wrong, documentaries that are speaking to the wrong people, an Arabic service that quotes a guy 522 times who is particularly disparaging about Jewish people. And, of course, I've not even got near the Donald Trump story, but still a brilliant news division. Give me a break. David's in Walthamstow. David, say sorry or tough it out. Which is it?
Certainly got to say sorry because two of its executives have resigned, so that's already saying sorry. But if Britain loses its state broadcaster, we as a nation will lose that global soft power.
But why do you think? What makes you think that they would?
No, I'm just saying this is what the plan, the agenda seems to be at the moment. But the UK, you know, we don't have much left to be proud of in that respect. But the BBC brought into line is definitely worth fighting for.
And how is it to be brought into line, to use your expression, David?
I think you're going to have to look at the way, you know, the size of it, the way that it's allowing certain agendas to be propagated. And, you know, it just needs, I don't know how you do it because it's a huge institution. But definitely that's what's got to happen. And what I would say, though, is you have to realize that Donald Trump is trying to promote GB, Nigel Farage broadcaster. So this is showing you where the agenda is.
There's a world of difference because the BBC, as the state-funded broadcaster, has to be impartial. If GB News chooses to go down a certain direction or any of the other stations, it's very simple. The market will decide. If they're putting out content that nobody likes, nobody will watch it. The BBC doesn't have that option because it's funded in this unique fashion. But, David, you want it saved, but saved after considerable changes. Thanks for your input on that. Seamus in Wallington. Seamus, your view. Apologise? Yes? Good morning.
Morning to you, Nick. There's a lot of questions I'd like to ask. Why was it sat on for 6 months?
Right.
What is actually going on at the Arab desk and the Middle East desk? How does an organisation that prides itself on fact-checking information, how on earth could this happen? And why is the narrative from a lot of other journalists, and I'll name Sky News in this, I've listened to them this morning, telling us that this is Trump getting his pound of flesh. This is from Sophie Ridge, getting his pound of flesh, and that it was an error in judgment. It was a malicious doctoring of information.
I know, Sophie. Are you sure she wasn't just reporting what people are saying? I don't know that she would have, but it's not an error in judgment. This is the lunacy of it. It was quite deliberately manipulated. I think it's 54 minutes apart, two different chunks of his speech.
As annoyed as I am with the BBC, I don't want to advocate for it being got rid of, but it does need cultural and radical reform, and it's not just two people. The entire people involved in that, everyone involved in that Panorama programme, should be removed from the BBC, and the news desk needs radical reform, because it's not impartial. It's been biased since 2013-14. I've not taken news from it since 2015.
Seamus, thank you for that. We will return to this story, but there are other events that we have to chronicle, and one is, of course, the sad news that the woman has died after that attack in Birmingham. LBC's reporter in Birmingham, George Ike, joins us now with the latest details. George, good morning.
Nick, good morning. 21-year-old Jason Raphael appeared at Birmingham Magistrates Court accused of murdering 34-year-old Katie Fox after she died in hospital from her injuries after she was stabbed in the neck. It happened on Smallbrook Queensway, which is a very central street in the city, running between Birmingham New Street Station and the Bullring Shopping Centre. These women in Birmingham have told LBC that Katie's death has made them think more about their own safety whilst in the city.
At this point, you can't even go home without being safe. Like, maybe your mum could be calling you, asking you where are you. Next thing you'd be like, oh, I'm on my way home. And then suddenly you're not even on your way back home, which is kind of scary.
You're still apprehensive about...
You're on your guard.
You're on guard, yeah. I mean, we're on our own, but if we were with our children, we're a lot more cautious, constantly, like, looking out for their well-being more than ours.
You've always got to keep your head on a swivel, especially alone as a woman. Always just... Do you know what I mean? At that time as well.
The 21-year-old was in court for just 6 minutes during the hearing where he was remanded into custody. And during those 6 minutes, he was told to be quiet and look forward after he interrupted the hearing multiple times. He was wearing a grey police-issued T-shirt in the dock and was flanked by two officers in handcuffs as he came up from the cells. He's also been charged with two counts of causing actual bodily harm on the 27th of October and the 7th of November, possession of a Stanley blade on the 7th of November, and a charge of assault of a detention escort officer on the 8th of November. West Midlands police are asking anyone with information about what happened on Friday to come forward. He was told he wouldn't be asked to enter any pleas because the charges were too serious to be dealt with at the Magistrates Court, but that he and the charges will be sent to the Crown Court, and I'll be at that hearing tomorrow, Nick.
George Ike reporting, 7:27. Back to you, Delroy, for your views. No shortage of legal cases involving Donald Trump and the media. October 2024, President Trump sued CBS News for $10 billion, later moved up to $20 million over false edits to a 60 Minutes interview with former Vice President Kamala Harris. The parent company Paramount settled the lawsuit for reportedly $16 million. Okay, so it started at $10 billion with a B, went to $20 billion, settled at $16 million. March 2024, same year, ABC News, Trump sued them and one of their hosts over questions about a woman who jurors found Trump liable for sexually abusing and defaming. ABC News settled the case for $15 million in December, reportedly. So he has some track record there. This all goes back to, and I think to get probably the best take on it, you want to read Richard Littlejohn in the Daily Mail today, who spells out in searing detail how there is such groupthink at the BBC. If you'll allow that, as we were discussing yesterday with Les Hinton, a very distinguished journalist, who made the point that years ago all the BBC jobs were advertised in The Guardian, so people who read The Guardian would apply for the jobs. The Guardian is by many, many times over the most ordered newspaper in the whole of the BBC by a considerable margin. Never mind the fact that it is a successful newspaper, but it doesn't sell anything like The Mail, doesn't sell anything like The Sun, but they all take The Guardian. And, of course, the people who joined up all those years ago, well, that's what they now call the boss class, aren't they? They're the managers and middle managers. Delroy's in Finsbury Park. What should the BBC do, in your view, Delroy?
I think they should, Nick?
Yes, sir, go ahead.
Right. I agree. What they should do is pay the money.
I don't think this is going to work, old chap. Let's try you one last time. I know you're battling with... No, the line's gone completely. Let me turn... let me do a couple of these. Daryl in Dudley, the Trump piece on Panorama was disgraceful reporting and editing. The way it was put together suggesting he was inciting a riot. Yes, of course, the BBC should apologise. Imagine if it was CNN reporting similarly about a UK Prime Minister. Andy in Portsmouth. Well done, Trump. Team Trump all the way. I hope this marks the end of the BBC. Popular BBC programmes will be bought by other networks and we won't have to pay a TV licence anymore. Darren in Plymouth. I'm 34. I cannot remember the last time I watched anything that was produced by the BBC. When there's so much stuff that's impartial on YouTube, you get at any time. Why would you be glued to sitting down at a certain time to watch something on TV? Well, I'll answer that, Darren, with one word. Traitors. And I think it came in at about 11.5 million people. So when they get it right, they get it very right. When they get it wrong, it's calamitous. All right, we'll return to your calls on that. Also, in a few hours' time, hopefully, we will all pause and remember the extraordinary sacrifice that our armed forces have done down the years. But what do youngsters make of the poppy that we should all have somewhere on our person today?
My mum always used to make me wear a poppy, but I'm going to be honest, I have no idea what any of that means.
I would never wear a poppy. I do support the soldiers who fought in World War One, obviously, but I think there's other ways to show support to those people.
Isn't it interesting? We specifically chose younger people. And I'm not critical at all of that fellow. World War One, it's not... I know it started in World War One. It's for the most recent conflicts as well. For blokes who went to Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere. And in some instances, didn't come back. That's later in the show. 7.30, breakfast with me, Nick Ferrari, here on LBC. News headlines, Lottie Morley.
The BBC has until the end of the week to respond to a potential billion-dollar lawsuit brought by Donald Trump. The US president says the organisation must retract false statements made about him in a Panorama documentary. The BBC says it will review a letter from Donald Trump's lawyers in due course. The rate of UK unemployment rose to 5% in the 3 months to September. The Office for National Statistics says it's up from 4.8%. The government says it's stepping up its plan to get Britain working. An independent commission has found the UK's counter-terrorism strategy is not fit for purpose. It says the definition of terrorism is too broad and too many people are being turned away from the Prevent programme. LBC weather, rain spreading to the north and west of the UK, but staying dry and bright in the south and east, highs of 16.
On the latest episode of The News Agents.
Is Donald Trump really responsible for bringing down the BBC Director General and the head of news? Or is there something much more murky going on within New Broadcasting House?
Get the latest episode of The News Agents with Emily Maitlis, John Sopel and Lewis Goodall. Listen or watch on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
Great to see you back at Specsavers. Okay, could you read out the letters on the wall for me?
Yep. D-E-A-L-S? D-E-A-L-S. Deals.
Oh, right. Our Black Friday deals are eye-catching, but the letter chart's over here.
Oh, sorry.
At Specsavers, we've got all sorts of unmissable Black Friday deals, like up to £50 off one pair of designer glasses. Offer ends on 7th of December 2025. Conditions apply. Ask in store for details. Chase is the digital bank you can count on.
How so?
Because you get 1% cash back on your grocery shop.
Like on prosciutto?
Yeah, prosciutto.
And seaweed crackers?
Sure, those two.
Well, hang on. What about rotisserie chickens?
If it's in your grocery shop, Chase has got your cash back. Join today and get 1% cash back on debit card spending on groceries, fuel and everyday transport. Chase, see what your money can do. 18 plus UK residents eligibility applies. 1% cash back for your first year. Maximum £15 per month. Exceptions apply.
At TfL, we're making tube journeys faster in the future with signalling improvements underway on the Circle, District, Hammersmith and City and Metropolitan lines. And there's also the Elizabeth line already giving you fast journeys across central London. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Elizabeth Line is fast compared to other TfL modes. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
7.33. Hopefully we've got young Delroy back on a better line. He will be one of many who want to have their say. It's not quite D-Day, but in a few days it will be D-Day for the BBC. Day up, or put up an apology or pay up $1 billion, which is going to be 600 and something, nearly 700 pounds, 700 million pounds, I would imagine. Let's go to a man who knows his numbers, Christian May, editor in chief at City AM, and we have some numbers on the scale of unemployment in the United Kingdom. What are we hearing? What are we learning? Christian, good morning.
Good morning, Nick. Yeah, unemployment figures released by the Office for National Statistics just half an hour ago show that the unemployment rate has hit 5%, confirming that it has risen pretty much every month for the last 12 months and now stands at that round and rather depressing 5% figure. There are about 180,000 fewer people payrolled jobs in the UK than this time last year, going down about 30,000 a month at the moment. We also learned that the claimant count, the number of people claiming out-of-work benefits, is around about 1.7 million, 20% of 16 to 64-year-olds economically inactive. So these are big structural challenges, and the government would say it's trying to unravel. But the bottom line is that businesses are cautious. They're nervous, their costs have increased, their employment costs have increased, and a lot of people are battening down the hatches in anticipation of the budget in a couple of weeks' time. So we don't expect any great change in employment sentiment among businesses for some time. The only other thing to say about this is that it might encourage the Bank of England to go for an end-of-year interest rate cut.
Right, all sorts of hints. You talk about what organisations might be doing. We're getting so many suggestions about what might be taking place in the budget, and for a story to get on the front page that's not about the BBC, it's obviously got to be a powerful one. Here's the Times. Rachel Reeves suggesting she's prepared to break Labour's manifesto, raising income tax but scrapping the two-child benefit cap. How much credence do we give that, Christian?
Well, for the second time in a week, the Chancellor sat down and gave, well, first of all, last week she gave a very long speech laying the groundwork for a budget. And then yesterday she sat down with the BBC for 15 minutes and talked a bit more about what she wants to do. So putting aside quite how unusual all this pitch rolling is, she did say that she's prepared to break Labour's manifesto, the manifesto commitments not to raise income tax, VAT, national insurance. Our monthly poll of UK voters, which we published today, shows that about two-thirds of the public say she should resign if she breaks those manifesto promises, including, by the way, about a third of current Labour voters. But she said that she's going to make choices based on her values and choices that are difficult. And one of those is on child poverty. She gave her strongest hint yet that she will fully reverse the two-child benefit cap. There had been some talk that it would be tapered or tweaked or some way reformed. It's a big deal to particularly Labour MPs. I'm sure it would be something that they have been calling for in the budget very loudly, supported by all sorts of former Labour grandees like Gordon Brown, etc. Chancellor said yesterday she doesn't think it's right that a child is penalised because they're in a bigger family through no fault of their own. So, yes, we're anticipating tax rises. We are also anticipating higher welfare spending.
What's a porch pirate?
Well, I tell you what, I can answer this because I've seen posters going up around my neighbourhood, photographs of people from doorbell cameras saying, look out for this person. About £660 million worth of parcels pinched from doorsteps by so-called porch pirates. About 20% of us have had an item stolen from our front door. I don't quite know how I feel about this. I mean, of course, there's no excuse or justification, but talk about an opportunistic crime. If it's right there, left unattended, basically on the pavement. I don't know. It doesn't seem to be terribly secure. But, of course, we're coming up to the busiest time of year for this particular crime. Most of these are not reported to the police, and you can't imagine the police dispatching the blues and twos because someone's Amazon parcel's gone missing. But we're getting up to Black Friday, Christmas. December is, of course, the worst month for this sort of offence. So I suggest people take all due precautions.
Who's Drastic Dave, and why does he feature on your front page, and what's his task?
Sir Dave Lewis, who was knighted a few years back for services to business and retail, he is known as Drastic Dave from his time running Unilever, where he cut costs drastically and rationalised their product lines and sorted that business out. He then went on to sort out Tesco, oversaw an extraordinary turnaround of Tesco, and he has now been drafted in to run drinks giant and Guinness maker Diageo, which has had a torrid time and its shares have slumped fairly consistently year on year. Can he turn it around? Can he raise their spirits? Well, investors raised a glass to him yesterday. Share price went up about 8%, settled about 6% up on the news of his appointment, and he will start that job, that enormous job, in January.
All right. And before I let you go, my eye's been drawn to a campaign you and your colleagues at City AM are backing, talking about financial literacy. Can I get a word on that from you, Christian?
Yes, that's very good of you, Nick. Thank you. Today, City AM is backing, launching, partnering with a charity called City Pay It Forward, which is an excellent charity that provides financial literacy education to school children. And City AM has partnered with them to launch our Year 6 dividend campaign. Now, never mind the fact that Chancellor is probably about to increase dividend taxes, we are hoping to raise £2 million to provide financial literacy education on everything from avoiding debt to understanding pay packets and feeling confident about managing money. We want to provide that education to every Year 6 child in the 2,000 schools in London. Maybe if it's successful, we'll roll it out across the country. That's the plan. But we are hoping to raise that £2 million to give £1,000 to each of the 1,800 or so primary schools in London to provide some training and some education to Year 6 students about financial literacy. So the website is year6dividend.com. We're hoping for some major institutional backing, but of course people can also support us in a number of ways. It's such an important topic. So that's year6dividend.com.
Just to clarify, 6 spelt out or the number 6?
That's right, it is S-I-X, year6dividend.com.
Okay, good luck with that. Let's have an update perhaps in a week or so. Christian May, thanks. Editor-in-chief at City AM, year6dividend.com, 7:40. Now, Delroy, coming to you for your views on the BBC in a moment, but there is, as we've just referenced, there's so much speculation about the budget. What's going to happen with the two-child benefit cap? What's going to happen with income tax, national insurance? What's going to happen with electric vehicles? What's going to happen with so many? The likelihood is that for many of us, we'll need a drop of the hard stuff after that budget, but there is concern in that industry over what might happen. Let's bring into the conversation Miles Beale, who's Chief Executive of the Wine and Spirit Trade Association. You and your colleagues have concerns about what we might hear in a couple of weeks' time. Mr. Beale, what are they and what backs up your fears? Good morning to you.
Good morning, Nick. Yeah, yes, you're quite right. Look, we're worried because we want the government to do as it says and give business a backing, give us a bit of a chance. The reason we're worried is we're expecting duty increases on alcohol yet again. Not passing on those increases would actually be better for businesses, better for consumers, and actually better for the exchequer as well.
Why? My listeners will think that's counterintuitive. Surely they should be coming to try and put a few more quid on a bottle of wine or a bottle of vodka or whatever it might be. Miles.
You're right, it is. It's counterintuitive. But these are the facts. Duty receipts are down 4.6% for April to September this year compared with last year. That's a bit of a trend of the last few years. The Office of Budget Responsibility continues to produce figures that the government thinks are sacrosanct. It says that duty receipts will go up if you put tax up. Actually, the evidence of the last few years is completely the opposite. This year, it's even more interesting because if you add duty, all the increases that government's passed on, national minimum wage, national insurance rises, etc., businesses under real pressure. We think it's pretty likely that all of those increases will result in about £1 billion less for the exchequer than would be the case if they didn't pass on those interest costs. So no duty rise would be better for everyone. That's what the Chancellor should do.
And just to back up your figures, that 4.6 you mentioned, I've got a note, that's worth nearly £300 million in and of itself.
Yes, exactly. So that's how far we are down this year and added in together with other costs. For example, there is a new tax just brought in on glass. That's adding about 10p to a bottle of wine and about 15p to a bottle of spirits. Add all this stuff together and we're significantly worse off. So that's worse for consumers and your listeners, worse for my businesses, and ironically, worse for the exchequer as well.
So you and your colleagues at the Wine and Spirit Trade Association have done your sums. Do you sense anyone in Whitehall is listening or wants to listen, Miles?
Frankly, Nick, no, not so far. We get the impression that they're rolling out the same old script they have year after year, where we've seen the same thing. Exchequer receipts going down, businesses under, you know, more and more of the cost, and actually consumers having to look at bigger increases. I mean, actually, if this goes ahead this time, then consumers will see on a 14.5% ABV bottle of wine almost a pound increase compared with January 2024.
Maybe we'll talk again after the budget. Thanks for your time this morning. Miles Beale, Chief Executive of the Wine and Spirit Trade Association. Of course, in the build-up to the budget, we need to remind you, you will hear it here and all the analysis you need later in the month. 7:43. Delroy and Finsbury Park's on a better line. Delroy, what would your advice be to the BBC? Pay up or put up a fight?
Pay up.
Definitely not put up a fight. Number one, they were wrong.
Yep.
So it'd be cheaper for them to pay, to say sorry and not to be sued, because $1 billion will, I believe, will probably wipe out the whole of the BBC. And also, if they do get a massive fine, it's only the guys who are paying the licenses, that's going to be their money gone. So they need to fess up. Obviously, they've screwed up, and they were wrong, completely wrong.
They were.
And so they
do you, how much trust do you have in them now, Delroy?
None. Zero. 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 Zero.
All right. Okay, it is a litany of mistakes. Delroy, I'm glad we got you. Very punchy. Glad we got you back on a better line. Have a good day. I'm only going to get one more in ahead of the news update. Bob in Chalgrove. Bob, what should the BBC do now? Good morning.
I certainly apologise, because I've been brought up to believe if you do wrong, hold your hands up and say sorry.
Yes, good point. Absolutely.
But my point about the BBC, which I've got a little bit of experience with, but the BBC, to me, have got a history of this. They've done it in 1984, with the Orgreave...
miners' strike, right.
Where there was controversy about the film footage that the BBC subsequently admitted had been edited to show various factions in the wrong light. An apology was issued. I thought they apologised to Thatcher, but subsequent research says that they didn't, but they apologised to the public and to the miners.
Right.
I don't remember it that way. I remember that they issued a full apology to Thatcher. I remember reading that in the Telegraph.
Okay. I'd forgotten that. Bob, thank you. I can take you back to Martin Bashir and that shameful treatment of the late Princess Diana for that interview there, but you've taken this even further back to the litany. It is an extraordinary organisation, Bob. Thanks for your input. Just a couple of weeks ago, we were praising the work it did with that undercover operation at Charing Cross Police Station. Do you remember when we saw the most appalling, what would appear to be examples of racism? Better tread carefully, because I think charges are still out there. But what certainly reportedly or allegedly could be deemed to be racism, tremendous undercover work there. And then they commit this absolute, what they call in the industry, journalistic fail. Extraordinary. All right, coming up later in the show, one in, one out, one big farce. But speaking as recently as last month, Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper said of it...
It's still at the pilot phase, but that has huge potential because that is returning for the first time. People who arrive on small boats.
And there were north of 1,700 of those. That's right, this last weekend. 1,700, I think, and 22, but certainly 1,700 and something arrived on the weekend. And still they pretend this deal can work. What would it take? 7:46 LBC News headlines, then Lottie Morley.
The BBC has until Friday to respond to a potential $1 billion lawsuit brought by Donald Trump. The rate of UK unemployment rose to 5% in the 3 months to September. And an independent commission has found the UK's counter-terrorism strategy is not fit for purpose. LBC weather, rain spreading to the north and west of the UK, staying dry and bright in the south and east with highs of 16.
LBC Travel, I'm Joanne Webb. There are long delays on the northern stretch of the M25 in both directions to junction 24 at Potter's Bar. There's been an accident clockwise, and that's causing delays back to junction 23 at South Mimms. And then anti-clockwise, there are delays because a car's broken down, and that's causing delays back to junction 25 at the A10. The A127 is closed westbound at the halfway house, and that's because of an accident. There are delays back to Laindon. And also the A3 southbound, only one lane is open at the Malden underpass, and that's causing delays all the way back to Shannon Corner. On the trains, Great Western Railway are still disrupted to and from Paddington, and no Gatwick Express trains running after a signal failure.
This is LBC.
At Morrison's, the best mince pies are half price. So you can buy six of the best mince pies for £1.50 and nine of the best mini mince pies for £1.75. Remember to leave one for Santa. Morrison's, making more of Christmas. Majority of stores, offers and prices may vary online at Morrison's. Daily six-pack was £3, nine-pack was £3.50.
This is LBC. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app. Download it now from your app store.
Train to Brighton with the besties. Immaculate vibes, as always. But I bet my ice skating is going to be pure chaos.
Oh, Em, you better hold my hand. Oh, I'm going up.
No, styled it out. I've got this.
Last one to the other side buys the hot chocolate.
Back on the train, only fell twice.
Low-key legend.
We have to do this every year.
Download the Southern Railway app to book tickets and save a third off group travel and off-peak journeys. Southern Railway, where every stop is a story.
Do you know your state pension age? No. Maybe you're not sure, or you don't know how to check. It's so quick and easy to check online. All you need is your date of birth. Knowing your state pension age helps you think about your future. So check yours today. Search state pension age on gov.uk and simply enter your date of birth. State pension age. It's good to know.
To be honest, work had been a slog. I'm a designer, but some nights I was chasing invoices like my full-time job. Now Sage Copilot chases my invoices for me. I just need to click a button and it's done. And I get paid 1 week faster.
Sage Copilot is built with over 40 years of experience helping real businesses like Sophia at Solver Design. That's more than artificial intelligence, that's authentic intelligence. Search Sage Copilot to learn more. Working with 21 customers, each round payments came in 7 days faster with Sage Copilot. T's and C's apply.
We had our smart meter installed a year ago, and it's made things so much easier. Not having to submit meter readings or having to deal with estimated bills is great.
A smart meter sends meter readings direct to your energy supplier. It means you get accurate bills, not estimated bills, and you don't even need an internet connection. Call your energy supplier to request a smart meter today.
Real testimonials voiced by actors. Eligibility may vary.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Call 0345 6060973.
10 minutes before eight, back to our conversation about the BBC in a moment. Now, a government that was elected on a plan or programme for change, they want to bring in reforms to strengthen standards and rebuild confidence in local government. Here with more details, Labour MP and Minister for Local Government and Homelessness, Alison McGovern. Good to have you on, Minister. In what way do you believe that the confidence has been lost? Can you cite some examples? Morning to you.
Good morning. I think since 2011, when the standard system for local councillors was taken apart, I think unfortunately there have been a number of examples where councillors have been charged with or have in some cases been found to have done quite serious things, in some cases you've violent offences or threats of violence, where
in some cases criminal convictions, one
indeed,
has to say, Minister. Yeah,
Where they have remained as councillors, and that's not what would happen in anybody's normal life at work. And I think it's right that we give powers back to councils to suspend and to stop paying money to councillors where that is the case. Of course, you'll know and everyone will know the vast majority of local councillors are really good local servants. We're talking about those few cases where there are really serious problems and councils need to be able to act.
So in what way do you and your colleagues want to change it, Minister?
So we want to bring forward legislation as soon as we've got the opportunity to do so, to re-establish a national system where there's a code of conduct, where councillors know what standards are expected of them, and where there's a clear process if somebody needs to make a complaint or, as we've just said, if there's a police issue. That will give the council then the power to make suspensions of councillors if necessary, to stop paying them money where councillors receive payment and allowances, and then to, you know, if a councillor is suspended for long enough, then obviously they can be removed in the extreme cases. We'll also make sure that there's a national appeals mechanism as well, and that all parties will be supported, and both the person making a complaint, if that's necessary, and the person being complained about. So we've got to bring back a strong national system for local government.
And how will residents of local authorities know about this? Will there be like a national helpline or a website? Where would they go if they feel they're being failed by a councillor?
Yeah, we'll create a national system that means each council needs to have this mandatory code of conduct. Many councils would already, for example, have on their own website how to make a complaint if you're not happy about a councillor. The problem is that those codes of conduct or those systems don't have real teeth, and that's what we'll be reintroducing. So in the first instance, you should be able to find information about this on your council's website. We'll obviously update the government web pages as well, and then there'll be a national backstop of an appeals mechanism as well, which we'll make public through the usual ways on the government's website and so on.
OK, one question I haven't asked you. When is this all likely to be in place, Minister?
So it will take national legislation to do this. The 2011 Localism Act undid the old system where councils did have powers. So it will take primary legislation. And I'm not going to hang about. Just as soon as the leader of the House is able to find time, we'll bring that forward. And in the meantime, we'll be working with local councils and others to get the legislation prepared. We actually did a consultation about this question, about whether we should have standards in this way with teeth. And we had over 2,000 responses to that consultation, and 94% of those responses said that we should do this. So we'll be working with all of those people who are interested, mainly with councillors themselves, to get this right.
All right, Minister, while I have the benefit of you on the line, a couple of other questions. In your view, should the BBC apologise to President Trump for the so-called doctored video?
If they've made an editorial mistake, then they should apologise. And we've just been talking about standard systems, and I think the BBC is probably chock full of policies on what they should do when they make editorial mistakes. So I think they should stick to it. And more broadly, Nick, I think if they've made errors, I think the answer to that is better quality journalism and to invest in that journalism so that we can have the standard of programmes we all want from the BBC.
Do you think their journalistic standards are slipping a little bit, Minister?
I think on the whole, not, because if you look at the levels of trust people have in the BBC, it's extraordinarily high. I think the BBC are in a unique place. They can bring stories from my constituency in Birkenhead, and they deal with massive global issues too. And they have this incredibly high level of trust. The thing that I would ask of them as a politician, you know, I won't always like the questions I'm asked by any journalist, but the thing I would ask of them is invest in that proper journalism. And if you've made mistakes, say sorry.
All right. On other matters, are you still going to offer defence of the one-in, one-out deal as we learn a second Channel migrant deported to France has returned to the UK, and over the weekend, 1,772 small boat migrants arrived in this country? This has been a fiasco, hasn't it, Minister?
Well, I am going to defend it, and that's because we know about the story that you've just mentioned, because our new security checks have clearly caught this person. Yes. And the discussion of this sends a message to anybody that that system is working.
But, Minister, why are the numbers at 1,700? If it's such a strong deterrent, clearly they're not listening in Calais and Gravelines. 1,772 people crossed the Channel, Minister.
No, but they will be listening, and they will know that we've deported 250,000 people. Well, the reason why people keep coming are not simple. There's wars in the world. There are issues and problems that cause migration and cause people to flee conflict and other things as well. You will know very well that there's also problems of organised crime and trafficking and
but
so
there's
on.
There's no crime in France. Why do they come here? Because they know it's a soft touch.
Well, if there are areas where we haven't enforced our borders properly, we need to tackle that. And that's why I support investment in our border force. That's what we need. And to have an agreement with our nearby neighbour in France that we will act together to stop channel crossings. Nobody wants to see these small boats because it's a danger to human life and it's a risk to our security. And we have to work with France to stop it.
And lastly, it was reported yesterday that there could be an initiative under which people who have arrived here and are staying in these so-called asylum-seeking hotels are offered £100 a week if they leave the hotel. As the Homelessness Minister, where are they meant to go?
Well, I haven't seen that report, but the thing that I would say as the Homelessness Minister
Would you support the initiative, Minister?
I'm not sure exactly, forgive me, Nick, I'm not sure exactly which initiative you're talking
about. I don't know which department it's from the Home Office.
Okay.
It's to get the hotel bill down, and obviously it currently costs around £1,015 a week to put someone in one of these asylum-seeking hotels. Instead, they're given £100, but it's not clear where they're meant to go. Perhaps sleep at a friend's house. Not sleep with a friend, sleep at a friend's house.
That would be something else.
We don't want to do a BBC moment here. On you go, Minister.
I think we all want the hotels to close because of the cost, as you mentioned. You'll know, Nick, that the Ministry of Defence are standing up sites as an alternative to that. I do worry about the impact on rough sleeping And where somebody is leaving asylum accommodation because it's been agreed that they are a refugee, we need to make sure that they get into stable accommodation as quickly as possible. And I would also say that they get help to find a job, because the sooner that person is able to rebuild their life and work and pay tax, that will help their local community and it will mean they can move on with their life.
Grateful for your time. As part of the Pride in Place strategy, sweeping reforms to strengthen standards, rebuild trust in local government, as outlined by Alison McGovern, Minister for Local Government and Homelessness. 228. Let's take one call. Last quick call on the BBC. Austin in Norbury. Which way should they go and why? Austin, good morning.
Oh, good morning, Nick. Lovely to talk to you. I really like your programme.
Oh, that's very kind of you, sir. Thank you. I really like this call. Now, what are you going to tell me?
Well, I'm going to tell... I don't want to say I'm going to tell you. I just feel there needs to be a bit of balance in the BBC debate. Yes, they need to apologise, but I don't understand Donald Trump wanting to sue us for billions. It's Great Britain, not America, and he's the master of fake news.
Well, I don't know if he's always the master of fake news. He's been successful in some other lawsuits. It's called reputational damage, lastly, Austin. His lawyers are saying it's reputational damage. Your response to that?
Well, I think that, reputational damage, but he's created mayhem in the... basically,
All right. The music means we must move on, but you are also saying, of course, that he has some questions to answer to. Austin, thank you for coming on. We might return to that story, but definitely after the news. That one in... one out deal. The Prime Minister, in July.
I'm pleased to announce our agreement today. Migrants arriving via small boat will be detained and returned to France in short order.
Plus, Prince William saying that they told their children everything about the fact that their mother had cancer. Have you been faced with that stark, stark conversation that you had to have? And do young people understand the significance of the poppy on, of course, this 11th day of the 11th month? Those stories and more. Follow the 8 o'clock news on LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 8 o'clock, Donald Trump is threatening legal action against the BBC after criticism over the way they edited one of his speeches. The US president says he wants an apology and for them to retract the whole programme by the end of this week, or he'll sue them for $1 billion. Gordon Rayner from the Daily Telegraph broke the story, which led to the resignations of Tim Davie and Deborah Turnis. He told Nick the BBC should apologise to the president.
They've already said that they got this wrong. They've already apologised for the fact that they doctored that speech. Why is he saying that they're considering what to do regarding Trump's demands? They just need to apologise to the man. They've done him a terrible disservice.
Government Minister Alison McGovern has told Nick the BBC should invest in better journalism.
The thing I would ask of them is invest in that proper journalism, and if you've made mistakes, say sorry. And more broadly, Nick, I think if they've made errors, I think the answer to that is better quality journalism and to invest in that journalism so that we can have the standard of programmes we all want from the BBC.
So Ella Braverman has told LBC the fallout between the president and the BBC has left the prime minister in a difficult position. The former Home Secretary says Sir Keir Starmer must choose between appeasing Donald Trump and backing the public broadcaster. You can read that piece in full on the LBC website. More than 2,500 businesses have been raided in a month in a bid to clean up Britain's high streets. Police across the UK targeted barbers, vape shops and car washes suspected of being a front for criminal activity. It's led to more than 900 arrests. And the Prince of Wales will tell young people about the importance of wearing a poppy. William will appear in a video about Armistice Day being played out in school assemblies. Philippa Rawlinson is from the Royal British Legion.
We've seen the nation come together across the weekend on Remembrance Sunday with moments right up and down the country with communities gathering to remember. But Armistice Day is just as important.
We'll be observing the silence at 11 o'clock here on LBC. In the city, the FTSE 100 will reopen at 97.87 after closing up 105 points yesterday. The pound buys $1.32 and €1.14. LBC weather, rain spreading to the north and west of the UK throughout the day, but staying dry and bright in the south and east with highs of 16 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Lottie Morley.
Debbie was in a bit of a pickle. Her crisp and gherkin sandwiches just weren't selling.
Hmm.
until she had the good idea to use Canva to design her logo, menus, and social posts. They looked good. Really, really good. Turns out crisp and gherkin sandwiches are right up everyone's street. Even if that street now smells of pickles.
Thanks, Canva.
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation with Nick Ferrari at breakfast.
Good morning, 3 minutes after eight, Tuesday, November the 11th. One in, one out, one big farce. And by the way, 1,772 people arrived in this country by small boat crossings over the weekend. It is not serving in any way, shape or form as a deterrent. That's the reality. In other news, how can a flag create a no-go zone? Prime Minister Keir Starmer telling the party conference back in September that Labour would never surrender the flag.
Let's fly all our flags, conference, because they're our flags. They belong to all of us, and we will never surrender them.
And you remember his poor senior colleagues having to wave those small flags, whether it was the Scottish Saltire, the Dragon of Wales, the England Cross, whatever it might have been. Well, now this report suggests that some NHS staff have really effectively, that they're working in a no-go zone because of these flags. We'll look at that in more detail. At 11 o'clock this morning, of course, we need to honour the flag and those who fought for us and never returned or came back with life-altering injuries. But do young people understand what a poppy actually signifies?
I used to wear one when I was in school. I used to always get one, have it on my blazer.
Would you wear one now?
Off my own accord, probably not, just because I don't really know anything about it.
My gran always wore one. She'd buy me one if we were out at the shops. And I don't wear one currently.
Plus, opening up to your loved ones about cancer. Prince William speaking with the Brazilian TV host Luciano Huck about being honest with his children.
We choose to communicate a lot more with our children. Now, that has its good things and its bad things. Sometimes you feel you're oversharing with the children, you probably shouldn't. But most of the time, hiding stuff from them doesn't work.
Have you had to have a conversation like that? Or in my case, have you been on the receiving end of a conversation like that? And what do you recall? That's later in the show.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
As I was discussing with the minister about a quarter of an hour ago, a second Channel migrant deported to France under the one-in, one-out deal has returned to the UK. Currently unidentified, I'm going to say he, I've no idea, but it's easier. He came back to the UK on a small boat on Sunday. Oh, it is a he, following his removal to France. It comes less than a week after an Iranian man, who's earned the nickname the Hokey Cokey migrant, was finally sent back over the Channel, having returned on a small boat a month after he was originally deported. The second migrant is understood to have been identified by his photo and fingerprints when he arrived and has been detained in preparation for a return to France. He was one of 348 small boat migrants picked up in the Channel by Border Force and taken to Dover Harbour following the arrival over the weekend of 1,772 small boat migrants over 3 days to Saturday. So there's an additional 2,100. This scheme's working well, isn't it? That deterrent that the then Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, told us it would be, the Prime Minister told us, I think Shabana Mahmood told us it will work as well. It's not working, and it's a farce, and the government just need to accept. Now, as I say, about 15 minutes ago, I was discussing this as a Minister for Local Government and Homelessness. I stress that last word because, in many instances, of course, these people here, and you have to have sympathy towards them because they can't get a house. If they don't get into those hotels, they sleep rough. And I put it to her, the latest fiasco of this deal, was she still going to offer any form of defence?
I am going to defend it. And that's because we know about the story that you've just mentioned, because our new security checks have clearly caught this person. Yes. And the discussion of this sends a message to anybody that system is working.
But Minister, why are the numbers at 1,700? If it's such a strong deterrent, clearly they're not listening in Calais and Gravelines. 1,772 people cross the Channel, Minister.
No, but they will be listening and they will know that we've deported 250,000 people. Well, the reason why people keep coming are not simple. there's wars in the world, there are issues and problems that cause migration and cause people to flee conflict and other things as well. You will know very well that there's also problems of organised crime and trafficking and
but
so on.
But there's no crime in France. Why do they come here? Because they know it's a soft touch.
Well, if there are areas where we haven't enforced our borders properly, we need to tackle that. And that's why I support investment in our border force. That's what we need. And to have an agreement with our nearby neighbour in France that we will act together to stop channel crossings. Nobody wants to see these small boats because it's a danger to human life and it's a risk to our security. And we have to work with France to stop it.
We'll be speaking with someone who was a special advisor to Immigration Minister Caroline Noakes. That's Claire Pearsall in just a moment. 8:09. Let's bring David Hague, a human rights lawyer and campaigner, into the conversation first. Do you accept this one in, one out is a farce now, Mr. Hague? Good morning.
Morning, Nick. Utter farce. And I think the minister clearly hasn't had a Weetabix because she sounds quite deluded if she's not able to.
Are you receiving payments from Weetabix, Mr. Hague?
No, I'm not. She also hasn't had a Shreddies or
a porridge. Yeah, on you go.
So, I mean, it is a farce. And I think this is the thing. I understand her point by saying she kind of implied that once the message that people will be sent back again, after they've already been sent back again, will get round to people, how long that will take, it might have an effect. It's not a deterrent. And I don't think it ever was going to be. And it won't be a deterrent until every single person would be sent back. That isn't going to happen. We already know that. Now, one of the things that I mentioned, I think I mentioned it to your producer, that I'm seeing is almost like a buy one, get one free deal that the smugglers are offering people. If you get failed when you come in the first time, you get a free second shot. Now, you know, they're adapting. These people are very, very, you know, they're businessmen at the end of the day. They're there to make money. They don't care what they're smuggling, whether it's people or rum. They're despicable people.
Yep.
They know they're adapting to our government, and our government is too slow. And, you know, you do have genuine asylum seekers. We absolutely do. And we absolutely must protect them. But a lot of people that are coming across the channel are not. And I think we all know that. And this is a real problem because we're not dealing with this effectively. You know, the previous government did, the current government hasn't been able to. And I think, you know, what we'll see happening if, and this is a big if, we see the people smugglers realizing that they'll get sent back and the marketing goes so people won't come across. You've got to look at what people are coming across. Are they coming across because they want protection from their life being in danger? That's the genuine asylum seekers. Are they coming across to work illegally, or are they coming across to get stuck in an asylum hotel system where they get free accommodation and money for a couple of years? And if they basically want to work, they'll start avoiding the channel and they'll come into areas like where I live in Cornwall. We saw a couple of months ago, a boat hired in France come in and across with migrants into Falmouth. They don't want to be found. They want to basically go into the black economy. The one in, one out poll isn't going to affect that at all. That will actually probably push people into areas like Falmouth and unmonitored coastline, so people just slip quietly into the dark economy.
It really is back to those days of smuggling, isn't it, where Cornwall featured so significantly, the county from which you're speaking. So, digital ID, Mr. Hague, is that part of the solution?
I don't know what the problem is, if that's the solution. I mean, I think, you know, I don't see...
That means that they perhaps won't find it as easy and they won't be able to work in nail bars and car washes. Is what, I'm not saying that's the case. Yeah. It's what the government would say, Mr.
I don't believe so. I mean, you know, back in the day when I trained in immigration, which is good, probably two decades ago, you know, people were supposed to have ID now. You're supposed to be able to provide a proof of ability to work before you get a job. Mm. There's still people, illegal people are still actually getting jobs. The type of employer that will give illegal people basically the chance to work, they don't care about digital ID. They'll find a way around it, like they found a way around with passports. It's I don't think it's going to help with the problem that we have of people getting work illegally. I don't see that helping.
Final question. You've been pretty caustic as the one in, one out deal. It was of a raft of measures. There was also a new border force or border security command, and we were going to sort of go, if I can use the expression, upriver and try and catch the traffickers. This is your everyday bread and butter, your everyday working life. What's the reality that you're hearing?
I mean, the Border Fast, I think, is more of the one. I think they're on strike in about a week, aren't they, in any event, or a big bunch of them. So, you know, I think, you know, I don't see, like I said, the previous government couldn't get a grip on it. It was more about optics and their press release kind of driven policy. And I think the current government is sadly falling into that, obviously because of the various pressures around them to get something done. And they're basically frightened about Nigel Farage and reform. So, you know, that's what we've now fallen into. We need medium to long-term solutions, and this government isn't providing any.
Enjoyed our conversation, David. Thank you. I sense we'll talk again. David Hague, human rights lawyer and campaigner, 13 after 8. To Claire Pearsall, who's a political commentator, served as special advisor to the Immigration Minister, Caroline Noakes, in a previous administration. Can I take you back inside the Home Office? And I'm sure this happened on your watch. A scheme is put up, whatever it might be about, and pretty quickly it's conceded this isn't going to work. How difficult is it to detach a government who've played so much of it and say, look, the reality is, folks, we've got to let this one go? Claire, good morning.
Morning, Nick. It's incredibly difficult for a government to let go of an idea, especially when they trumpeted on the media. They have ministers out there every day saying what a great idea it is and how tough they're looking. To row back on that is incredibly difficult politically. However, before a scheme even gets to being on the statute books, you need to be able to look at it from all angles. You need to understand where your problems are, where the loopholes are, and what your legalities are, and how much it's going to cost versus how much it's going to save. And then you can start building a defence. So sometimes you need to turn the scheme on its head and work from a slightly different angle, which this government seems to have just cobbled something together to get it out there, to get ahead of some headlines.
How frustrated were you when you were in post at what would appear to be, and tell me if I'm wrong, the lack of level of cooperation with the French?
Oh, it's incredibly frustrating. I mean, I spent a very, very cold January evening standing on the beach in Calais at midnight with the gendarme, with the French minister, looking across at the twinkling lights of Dover and how close they were. And they almost did the Gallic shrug as sort of, it's, you know, your problem. It isn't ours. We will do our best. You need to pay us more. And it's incredibly frustrating to try and get any kind of answer out of them as to how much they can do from their side and how willing they are to take people back or to stop them coming in the first place, arrest people, do whatever they can. They're just really not that fussed about it because they see as soon as they get to the beach, they become Britain's problem.
As ever, great speaking with you, Claire Pearsall. Thank you, political commentator. You serve as special advisor to Immigration Minister Caroline Noakes. One in, one out, one hopeless scheme, but what should happen now? And also after the news.
It's a barbershop crackdown. More than 900 people have been arrested and thousands of businesses raided in the biggest ever operation to clean up the high street. I'm LBC's Fraser Knight with all the details.
That also after the news. 8:15 LBC News headlines now. Lottie Morley.
Donald Trump is threatening to sue the BBC for $1 billion. There are warnings the UK's counter-terrorism strategy is no longer keeping the country safe. And more than 2,700 high street businesses have been raided as part of a UK-wide crackdown on money laundering. LBC weather raining across Wales, Northern Ireland and Northern England. Brighter in Scotland with highs of 16.
LBC Travel, I'm Joanne Webb. Long delays on the M25 on the northern stretch in both directions. The junction 24 at Potter's Bar. It's following an accident going clockwise and anti-clockwise. A car's broken down, so there are severe delays both ways. Same with the motorways on the M1 southbound. It's very slow to junction 10 at Luton Airport from 11 at Dunstable South. And that's also following an accident. A127 in Essex is closed westbound at the halfway house at West Horndon. It's following an accident as well, and there were queues back to Leyden. Now on the trains, these big problems do continue for the Gatwick Express. No service at all. The entire line is suspended, and Heathrow Express service is also disrupted after a signal failure.
This is LBC.
Save the Children is inviting you to the UK's most spectacular Christmas party. That's right, Christmas Jumper Day is back on Thursday the 11th of December, and Save the Children want every school and workplace in the country to get silly and donate for a seriously good cause. It couldn't be easier. Sign up, get your jumpers out, and this December join the millions of people creating lasting change with Save the Children. Sign up now at christmasjumperday.org.
Call Nick Ferrari now, 0345 6060 973 LBC.
How's the business going?
We're busier than ever, but struggling to get the staff we need.
Recruiting can be such a distraction. We gave Job Centre Plus a try, and they've really helped us out.
Really?
Yeah, it was dead easy. We got our own employer advisor, Julie, who helped advertise our jobs, shortlisted candidates for us, and let us interview at the Job Centre. We've hired some great people, and Job Centre Plus really took the hassle out of it. And there was no fee.
Brilliant. That's straight on my to-do list.
Find out more at business.gov.uk/recruit. Eligibility criteria apply.
Julie could part exchange her car. Or check out We Buy Any Car. She could be unsure if she got a good deal part exchanging. Or have cash in the bank with more bargaining power to get a bigger car for her five-a-side team. Totally played. Or total player. To get a quote in 30 seconds, enter your reg number now at webuyanycar.com.
Amazon offers term time working to their employees, like Anton, who's home to look after his daughters during their holidays.
Hello!
To him, this is the best sound in the world. Actually, maybe that's the best sound of all. Now that's term time working. Offered at Amazon. 10 weeks off guaranteed per year. Mix of paid holiday and unpaid time off. Conditions apply.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Coming to your calls regarding the one in, one out. I'm so sorry, when you take 4 days into account, 2,120 people arrived in the space of 4 days. 2,120. And this was meant to be a deterrent. Richard says, at the end of the day, digital ID is not going to stop an illegal immigrant getting a job. They will just pay them cash, which is what they are doing now. Jim says, Labour continues to bang on about people smugglers as if they're forcing people across the channel. Why can't they discuss the reality? Traffickers or not, these migrants are coming here illegally and should be dealt with as such. Can I tell you, I'm going to say something that I think is a bit drastic. You'd only have to turn around a couple of dinghies and they get the message. The Royal Navy, at the halfway point, or the Border Force, turn the dinghy around, escort it safely back into French water, take the flak from the French. They're not helping anyway. We've sent more than 400 million euro. I think it's 500 million euros. It's hundreds of millions of euros. Let's be conservative. 400 million euros. We've got zip in return. Turn a boat round. Just have one day. Every dinghy is turned around. Put the Navy on it. Put the Border Force on it. Get them all back safely, by the way. I'm not saying sink the boats. And just take the diplomatic fallout from the French, all screaming and shouting at us. I think that really is the only way. Tony's in Chichester. Tony, why do you suppose the one in, one out has exploded in such fast? Good morning.
Oh, dear, Nick. Anyone with an ounce of common sense knows that this one in, one out was a crackpot idea.
Mm.
And just like giving the immigrants £100 to leave the hotel.
Mm.
I was amazed that minister said she didn't know anything about it. It's been out there for days.
I know, and when you think she is the homelessness minister, so obviously
exactly.
These people, so I mean, they get £100 and they sleep on a moat, so say sleep on a mate's sofa, then they're going to be homeless after that.
Yeah, we need to get tough with the French. The new Home Secretary said she would do whatever it takes. So far, it's been deafening what she's done. If the police can't stop or won't stop the boats, then the French have got to bring in the military. Punch the boats, arrest the traffickers, and stop the stalls of where all these boats are coming from.
Well, punch the boats only if it's sort of knee-deep in water. I'm all for that. But once they're out at sea, and I think in most instances the French almost help push them away, I think we have a day where we do another Dunkirk. We turn everybody back and just take them back to France.
Well, it's Remembrance Day.
It is.
And all the people, you know, the Germans couldn't cross the water.
I'm reminded of that veteran who said, I don't know if you saw that story, I think he's 100 years old, he said it wasn't worth fighting the war now when he sees the state of the country. You can hardly blame him.
Bless him.
Yeah, I know. There's such bravery of that generation. Tony, thank you for reminding us. It is Remembrance Day, and we are looking at that later in this hour, I think. No, it's the next hour. Because it does occur to me, I put my poppy on, and I sometimes go striding around, and some people, young people, think, What has he got that for? One taxi driver asked, what have you got that for? I thought, wow, one day it's all going to be faded away. David's in Manchester. David, what needs to be done on this? Good morning.
Good morning, Nick. Why don't we just use the Dublin Agreement to return every single migrant that comes across on a small boat?
Because we haven't got the nerve to do it yet, and we have to now. We have to stop all benefits, we have to stop hotel accommodation, we have to treat these people as they've arrived here illegally, and we have to have one day, I'm going to choose Thursday of next week, and you turn every boat around. You put out the Navy, you put out the Marines, and you put out the Border Force. We're turning every boat
around.
But
there's a regulation already in place, Nick, the Dublin Regulation.
But they haven't got the nerve to go by it, David. That's what we've got with this government.
But the Dublin Regulation says that you can return every single migrant to the first country they enter.
But all France has to say is we won't take them, and we just...
Why not? They've got to.
I know.
It's a regulation.
Ask the Home Secretary. We're so super. You're right. We should be doing it, and that's what I want to do. David, I'm going to put you on one of the boats next Thursday. I'm only marking next Thursday. That's the day we're going to turn the boats around. We'll have more calls on that. David, have yourself a safe day. Two other matters. Have you, like by the area in which I live, noticed there seems to be more and more barber shops and vape stores? Well, thousands have now been raided in a crackdown on money laundering, with the National Crime Agency saying more than 900 people have been arrested in a month. It was the biggest operation ever done of its kind to clean up the high street. LBC's reporter Fraser Knight is in the studio with all the details. Fraser, good morning.
Nick, good morning. Every single police force in the UK was part of this operation, a real push to flush out criminality from so-called dodgy shops on the high street. 2,700 barbershops, vape stores, car washes raided across every corner of the UK. LBC had joined a number of those raids, as we saw more than 900 arrests being made for money laundering, drug supply, illegal working and the selling of counterfeit goods. Sal Melky from the National Crime Agency told me they've made a pretty decent dent in disrupting criminals at every level.
Now, those businesses range from everything that, you know, so-called lower-level criminality, so selling small amounts of illicit goods, so illicit tobacco or illegal and harmful vapes, all the way through at the top of the pyramid, where we see more organised crime doing higher volumes of cash and laundering that money through the business. But this will be disruptive, this will create jeopardy, and this will really land a hammer blow to those people that are exploiting our high streets and making them less safe and less prosperous.
Now, as I say, we had teams on several of the raids. In Plymouth, for example, we saw dozens of fake Labubu dolls being seized before staff at a cafe and a barbershop were then questioned on their immigration status. In Brixton in South London, I watched as six vape shops and phone stores were raided at the same time within just 200 metres of each other. And Inspector Ollie Lamb from the Metropolitan Police said he now plans to close them down.
For some premises, this will be the third visit this year. I will be working hard to ensure that these people inside the premises are prosecuted, and I will be doing everything I can to try and shut these businesses down to make way for legitimate businesses to take their place.
Elsewhere in Crawley in West Sussex, the Migration Minister Mike Tapp got involved as well, as a man was found to be working illegally at a car wash.
He told me he was here on a health and social care visa, but of course he's working cash in hand in a car wash. Now that's in breach of that visa's conditions, so he's been arrested for that.
Now, as you say, Nick, cash-heavy businesses have really grown on the high street in the past decade. More than £12 billion of cash is thought to be laundered through the UK every year. And if you look at areas like Essex and Doncaster, there's actually been a 200% increase in barbershops in the past 5 years. Until now, though, the issue of shops acting as a criminal front has been seen as too big for local police forces, too small for the National Crime Agency. They said they felt they needed to change that because of people getting so fed up of these shops plaguing their high streets.
LBC's Fraser Knight reporting, 8:26. Richard, you called with the idea of the Dublin Agreement. My thanks to Adam, to Craig, to Livio and others. Of course, with Brexit, we're no longer part of that Dublin Agreement, and I should have made that point, and I'm very happy to do that. So your idea was a sound one, but we're out of that. That's no longer in play, as it were. So let's come back to what we might be able to do. John's in Enfield. John, your take on one in, one out. Good morning.
Oh, hello, Nick. Yeah, I'm glad that you finally sort of turned around with my thought of thinking about actually turning the boat.
I know, mate. I know, I'm sorry. I just don't see... When you see 2,220, was it? Around 2,120, over 4 days. That's it. There's no other way. Get everyone safely back to Calais. I'm not saying shoot the boats. And then just take the fight with the French. Just take them on.
And I'd go a bit further than that, Nick, yeah? I think if any judge disagrees with that, or human rights lawyer disagrees with that, or any politician disagrees with that, yeah? I think we should stick him under curfew and don't let him off to 7 o'clock. Just get the army in, get them to sort out our borders.
Now, we were doing so well, John, and now you've gone raving. You must try the decaf. We were doing okay. Just had the decaf in the morning. John, you're on the same page. You're going to be with me on those cutters. But no, we're not going to start locking up lawyers who don't, or telling them they can't go out at night if they don't agree with us. But I do think up with this, we will not put that these ridiculous one in, one out. No, we've got to bare our teeth. John, good hearing from you. We're almost on the same page, although yours is slightly more to the right of the book than perhaps mine is. Richard's in Battersea. Richard, you're on the radio. Are you signing up to my scheme? Good morning.
Actually, I claim ownership of the scheme, Nick. I was banging on about this months ago.
Okay. I apologise.
There's a second refinement to it that you need to do. What you need to do is to set up a line along that midpoint you're talking about of booms.
No, we've talked about this, sir. We've got the ferries we have to get through.
No, you've got, say, a couple of points where you've got a ship at each end of a break in the boom where the ferries go through, right?
Well, migrant boats will use that gap as well, of course.
No. You patrol that intensively, those two gaps. The rest of it, you can have a sort of less dense patrol, but it does cover the approximately 40 or 50 miles.
What are we going to do when they start heading off to Cornwall?
Yeah, well, you got a big problem then, haven't you?
Well, we're almost there, and certainly we're agreeing that action this day, to use quote Church, is what's required. Richard, thank you. Peter says, completely agree, get the Navy out, turn the boats around. Florian's not impressed. Come on, you know it's not that simple. And the moment you try to turn around a boat, someone in that boat will damage the boat. All of them will be in the water. There'll be people in those boats who don't care. Well, we hoik them out. I have said we're going to put the entire Royal Navy that's available, which is probably about two ships and 20 blokes and women, but all the Navy, the Marines, the whole lot, will put the Air Force up. No one will drown. I repeat, no one will drown. They will go back to Calais, and there will be one heck of a fight. And I couldn't think I can get there quick enough. We'll take more calls on that. Coming up later in the show, the appalling news, the devastating news. Has had to be imparted once to me by my late father that you have cancer. And that's what Prince William and Kate had to tell their children. William talked about it on a Brazilian TV show.
We choose to communicate a lot more with our children. Now, that has good things and it's bad things. Sometimes you feel you're oversharing with the children. You probably shouldn't. But most of the time, hiding stuff from them doesn't work.
How did you impart that news? It's going to be a tough conversation, I know. It's 8:30, breakfast with me, Nick Ferrara on LBC. The news is read by Lottie Morley.
A government minister has told Nick the BBC should apologise to Donald Trump if they made an editorial mistake. The US president says he's going to sue the organisation if they don't retract false statements made about him in a Panorama documentary. Alison McGovern says the BBC should invest in its journalism to avoid errors in the future. An independent commission has found the UK's counter-terror strategy is no longer keeping the country safe. 90% of people referred to the Prevent programme are said to be turned away because their ideology isn't obvious enough. And more than 900 people have been arrested in a huge crackdown on money laundering. Police officers raided nearly 3,000 high street businesses, including barbers and vape shops. LBC weather, rain spreading to the north and west of the UK, but staying dry and bright in the south and east, highs of 16 degrees.
Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
I kept trying to say over and over again that the Tories left cuts of some £20 billion to public services. All of this was out there, all of this was available to see, and Labour deliberately closed their eyes to it, said that they were going to grow the economy and that they weren't going to increase income tax, national insurance or VAT. They knew that that was going to be a promise they would be hard-pressed to keep, if at all.
Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
This is what award-winning customer service sounds like from real Octopus Energy calls.
You just get it right, the customer service, the sort of communication. You've stepped it up, I think, for an energy company, so well done.
Octopus Energy, great value and outstanding customer service, recommended by Which? 8 years running.
Amazon has increased funding for employees to £3,000 a year every year for career development. Like Juliet, she's now a trained technician. And to her, the sound of machinery in need of repair reminds her of how far she's come. In 2 years, she's landed her dream job, providing her with valuable skills. That's up to £3,000 every year for career development at Amazon. Eligibility conditions apply.
How's the business going?
We're busier than ever, but struggling to get the staff we need.
Recruiting can be such a distraction. We gave Job Centre Plus a try, and they've really helped us out.
Really?
Yeah, it was dead easy. We got our own employer advisor, Julie, who helped advertise our jobs, shortlisted candidates for us, and let us interview at the Job Centre. We've hired some great people, and Job Centre Plus really took the hassle out of it. And there was no fee.
Brilliant. That's straight on my to-do list.
Find out more at business.gov.uk/recruit. Eligibility criteria apply.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running. Octopus Energy.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Call 0345 6060973.
Talk about turning those boats around mid-channel. Les is in Cambridge. Are you ready to sign up to my fairly drastic actions? Good morning.
I don't want to be the one who blows out your candle here, Nick.
What a lovely expression.
I know, it was the only one I was going to use.
Go on.
I think we all know that's not going to happen because of too many lawyers involved.
We're not going to tell them. We're just going to mobilise the Navy. I'm not going to seek approval. I'll beg forgiveness rather than seek approval or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I thought if I'm going to tell you that, I should come up with an alternative proposal.
Come on, then.
Health and safety is always the big issue. Turning them around, cutting the boats. How about, if they haven't got an engine, they're not going to go anywhere off those beaches, are they?
I like that idea. How are we going to get all the engines?
Well, this country has had some very clever and has some very clever scientists. Can we not devise something that you fire or get around those props, a mesh? Because if that engine's not going to turn, they're not going anywhere.
And where are we going to fire it? The French won't fire it, will they?
Well, I'm not saying fire. If we can't come up with a system, it's a floating system. It's something that just stops that propeller going round.
Okay, and I like the idea, and I'm sure it can be done. It sounds a bit Bond, James Bondish, but where are we going to put the mesh? You know, where are we going to launch the mesh? Halfway across the channel?
No, it's going to be at the beach.
Well, they won't let us. They won't let us, will they, the French? That's the problem.
It's not us. The French can. There must be a system. I go from a story an elderly neighbour once told me about. They went to Cornwall, decided to go out and have a look at an oil tank and their little boats with their outboard. When they got out about a mile out to sea, the rope dropped off the front, the mooring rope, went under the boat and got tangled around the propeller.
That's appalling because you've got absolutely no power. You're at the mercy of the waves.
Sometimes the simple things work. But we're not looking at it by the sounds of it. We're trying to cut the boat.
Just lastly, I get it. But again, and mine is a very confrontational idea, but I don't think they'll allow our personnel to operate on their beaches. Les.
No, I'm not saying us. I'm saying
they won't. They won't do it. They won't do it. We've given them $500 million. They ripped about our two.
Well, mustn't be so negative.
No, I know we shouldn't. And I don't want to blow your candle out, Les. Let's see what others make of it. Thank you. Ropes fired from the beach. At least then you stop the problem. No one's going to drown because they're hopefully only in water that's about knee deep. We'll come back to that conversation, but to other matters. And of course, it is Remembrance Day today. What have we got? 2 hours and 25 minutes or so. And of course, most of us will remember the Union flag on that occasion. But what of this report that England flags across the St. George of creating no-go zones for NHS staff around the country? Nurses and doctors report feeling intimidated by the number of flags in communities, including when they visit a patient at his or her home. Several NHS Trust chief executives said there are examples of staff being abused and threatened, including when they tried to take down flags outside their homes. Thousands of St. George's and Union flags have been put up in town, cities and villages over the past few months, supporters saying they're an expression of patriotism, but they have raised tensions around immigration and racism. To Professor Habib Naqvi, who's chief executive of the NHS Race and Health Observatory. Is this something of which you were already aware, Professor? Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Nick. Well, flags should be symbols of unity and inclusion, just as you've just highlighted. And they should be symbols of inclusion for all groups and communities. But as reports, such as the one published today by NHS providers, outline, they're also creating an intimidating environment for some people, and of course, including NHS staff. And it's not right that these symbols of belonging are in some cases being used to incite verbal and physical abuse, and sometimes on the basis of people's skin colour and nationality. I guess we need to remember as well, Nick, that this abuse is being targeted towards those very people who work day in, day out to look after us and to look after our loved ones during the most vulnerable moments in our lives.
And yet, it was only at the last Labour Party conference that we heard the Prime Minister saying, we will never surrender the flag. I don't know who'd asked him to surrender. And we'll celebrate the flag. And his senior cabinet ministers all then waved small flags of either Scotland, United Kingdom, England, or whatever it might have been.
Well, we know the NHS is a microcosm of wider society. Let's not forget 1.5 million people work in the NHS. And what happens in wider society, on our streets, is bound to be reflected in the workplace. But we must have an absolute zero tolerance around discrimination and racism of all forms. But, and so there must be a zero tolerance around, you know, around what we're seeing.
Professor, you made a bit of a jump there, haven't you, to say race. Are you saying that anyone who puts a flag up is racist?
No, I'm not. No, no. What I'm saying is that this pattern isn't new. We know for many years from evidence that NHS staff continue to report racial discrimination from patients as well as from colleagues. Mm. And these patterns are increasing year on year. And the evidence is very clear, Nick, as well. Happy staff equals happy patients. And staff engagement and satisfaction leads to better patient outcomes, patient care, and patient experience. So why wouldn't we want to create an inclusive environment for all of our NHS staff?
But someone who wants to celebrate their Britishness, or indeed their Englishness or Scottishness, what should they do?
Well, it's absolutely right to celebrate the flag. It's absolutely right that, you know, these are symbols of unity and inclusion, and they should be symbols of unity and inclusion. Mm. And they should not be kind of an excuse, or kind of they should not be used as a weapon to intimidate, you know, the very people that look after us day in, day out.
Who is using them as a weapon, Professor?
Well, it's what we see in wider society, isn't it? It's what we see on our streets. And of course, you know, we know right from the outset, you know, 1948 was when the NHS was established. And right from the outset, you know, people from abroad, have been the very backbone of our NHS. And so we should, you know, we should celebrate and we should look after, our healthcare staff.
No, I think it's just, I'm concerned you use words such as weapon or weaponize.
Well, that's what we're hearing. You know, that's what we're hearing from staff, and, you know, staff experiences. You know,
so your advice would be no flags?
No, that's not my advice. My advice
so
is
how,
that...
How do I know, by the way, I don't happen to fly a flag, but if I wanted to from my in my front window, how do I know if I can do it or not?
It's absolutely right to celebrate flags. It's absolutely right to make sure that we have that unity amongst our community. But it has to be all of our community. We need to be an inclusive.
Sorry, repeat my question, sir. How do I know that it's okay to fly my flag? I mean, I can't ask everyone who walks past my front door. So how do I know?
But Nick, it's about creating that unity. It's about that.
No, I hear that, and I want
we create.
So I'll ask again: how do I know that I'm not causing offence, or is it actually what you're saying is don't fly the flag because you want to make sure you're not causing offence?
No, what I'm saying is that it's absolutely right to fly the flag.
So I'll try again. What are the terms by which I can fly my flag?
Well, it's absolutely right to fly the flag, Nick, but it's about creating that belonging.
No, I hear you, sir. And it's creating unity. So how can I ensure that I'm not in some way expressing disunity or causing distress to our great army of men and women who make up the NHS? How can I ensure that's not happening, Professor?
But it's how we engage with each other. It's what kind of society we want to live in.
I can't engage with everybody walking past my front door. Can I put it to you? You don't know the answer to this question, Professor.
No, it's not, that's not the case.
Oh,
the case is that what we're hearing from patients and from staff is
that. Yeah, and I don't want that. That's what I want to make sure that, well, not patients because they won't be walking, but I want to make sure that in the event I decided to tie a union flag to my tree, that I'm not. So how can I make sure I'm not causing upset?
Well, what we're hearing, Nick, from patients is that there is abuse, violence, and racism to staff, and at times, you know, refusing treatment from qualified healthcare staff. And that's what we're about. You know, we're about tackling that at the heart. And that is unacceptable. And so you know, NHS organisations and people and the public need to understand that there needs to be a zero tolerance around the level of intimidation that we're seeing and the abuse and the racism that we're seeing within the NHS.
Yes, you still not told me how streets. I can fly my flag, though.
Well, you can fly the flag, but it's about creating that. It's about creating that environment where everyone is.
Well, it's my front garden. I can't create an environment in my front garden, can I? By the way, I don't. But maybe actually on Remembrance Day, if there's any day, it would possibly be on Remembrance Day that I would try and buy myself a Union flag. But I want to make sure I'm not upsetting anyone.
Well, yeah, but that's absolutely right. But it goes back to the point that, you know, flags are symbols of unity and inclusion.
All right.
They should be symbols of belonging and solidarity.
Well, they should. I'm grateful for your time. Professor Habib Naqvi is Chief Executive of the NHS Race and Health Observatory. Thank you for your input on that. How can we fly the flag without causing offence? 8:43. Will's in Newport. Will, your view on this? Good morning.
Good morning, Nick. Great show. Okay. I'd just like to say that it really grips the seat of my pants when people come on.
I've heard that before.
Speaking about the Union Jack, about other flags, about how it's intimidating, how NHS staff get intimidated. When we see NHS staff, when we see doctors and nurses wearing and demonstrating they can wear their I support Palestine, they're waving their Palestine flags.
Right.
That's offensive to the Jewish community and also to the community of the United Kingdom who find it offensive and live in fear. But no one ever criticises the Palestine flag.
It needs to be said there are cases actually going through before the GMC, the General Medical Council, about people, senior members of the profession, who have, in some instances, they've made unfortunate posts or disagreeable posts towards Jewish people, or in others, they've been downright rude. And some doctors have lost their jobs, by the way, for their comments about Jewish people. But your point is broader. Do you feel, when you see the Union flag or the Cross of St. George, what goes through your mind, lastly, Will?
I'm grateful and thankful that I live in a country that still at the moment we're able to demonstrate unity and strength, and we're able to speak our truth.
Well, how poignant those words. Remember, it is, of course, Remembrance Day, and that's just, a couple of hours or so away, two and a bit? And we're going to be doing a report on that later in the show. We're coming back to coming back to the biggest story of the day, biggest story of the week. I would have thought there's a fair chance, by the way, that Telegraph's looking at being Newspaper of the Year for the work it's done on this BBC scandal. And here's one of its senior editors, associate editor of the Telegraph, Gordon Rayner, speaking with me about this pay the fine or apologise ultimatum from President Trump.
I do not understand why he's dithering. They've already said that they got this wrong. They've already apologised for the fact that they doctored that speech. Why is he saying that they're considering what to do?
The he there being, of course, the BBC chairman, Samir Shah. It's 8:45, LBC News headlines then, from Lottie Morley.
A government minister has told Nick the BBC should apologise to Donald Trump if they made an editorial mistake. An independent commission has found the UK's counter-terror strategy is no longer keeping the country safe. And more than 900 people have been arrested in a huge crackdown on money laundering. LBC weather, rain spreading to the north and west of the UK, but staying dry and bright in the south and east. Highs of 16 degrees.
LBC Travel, I'm Joanne Webb. On the trains, no Gatwick Express. The entire line is suspended. Also, no London Northwestern between Watford Junction and St Albans Abbey. And also, there are problems on the Elizabeth line. Severe delays between West Drayton and Reading. It's because of a signal failure, which means there are delays on Great Western Railway and Heathrow Express services to and from Paddington. On the motorways, there are long delays on the M25 in both directions. So Junction 24 at Porter's Bar, anti-clockwise because a car broke down earlier, and clockwise is slow because of an accident. And the M1's very busy southbound from Junction 11 at Dunstable South to 10 at Luton Airport, and that's following an accident and one lane is closed.
This is LBC.
Hey Sainsbury's, off to my neighbour's Christmas do later. Got any gift ideas?
How about our Taste the Difference chocolate chip shortbread tin, deliciously Moorish all butter biscuits in a bougie box? Or give them a treat for the eyes and the taste buds with our indulgent Taste the Difference cherry and amaretto panettone. What do you think?
I think I'd rather keep them for myself.
Looking for a tasty festive gift
Ask Sainsbury's. Sainsbury's, good food for all of us.
Subject to availability, available in selected supermarkets and online.
Call Nick Ferrari now. 0345 6060 973 LBC.
At TfL, we're helping to make bus journeys greener. Our entire bus fleet is 100% low or zero emission at the tailpipe, including those for our Superloop routes, helping improve air quality for all. And we'll have a fully zero emission fleet by 2034. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
No one sees your small business like you do. The feeling when that unexpected big contract comes in. The butterflies. But that's the exciting bit of it being your business. And you wouldn't have it any other way. So breathe it all in. When your business is your life, we exist to help you live. Search O2 Business.
Every investor has a future in mind, whether it's seeing your kids through uni or picturing yourself retiring in Tuscany. The hard part can be knowing how to get there. JP Morgan Personal Investing can help you see the path ahead. With our intuitive app, expert support, and 150 years of JP Morgan's investing experience, you can start making more informed investment decisions today. Search JP Morgan Personal Investing. Invest with clarity. Capital at risk.
The £5 meal deal from McDonald's. Get a cheeseburger or mayo chicken, medium fries, four McNuggets, and a medium soft drink for guess what? That's right, £5. It's not called the £5 meal deal for nothing. From 11 a.m. Not available on delivery. Carbonated soft drink upgrade fees apply. Participating restaurants subject to availability.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Chris Innesham, Irvine in Scotland, you've been hanging on a long time to talk about migration, then we might move the conversation on to flags and concerns. We don't want anyone working in the NHS to feel in any way intimidated, but equally, if someone wants to fly the flag, particularly on this day of all days, they want to be able to do it without thinking they're causing distress to NHS staff. But migration, Chris in Irvine, you're on the radio. Morning, Chris.
Morning, Nick. Yes, it's one of these things where I think migration is only going to get worse if the UK is going to cut world aid. Mm-hmm. And we need to start making these people's homes that they're fleeing a safer place to stay to stop them travelling through Europe to come to the UK. Why is it always, let's turn the boats around? Why is it not, let's make the country a safer place to live?
How are you going to make South Sudan more appealing than South Croydon?
Well, Nick, to be fair, I'm only phoning this radio station up giving news suggestions. Yeah. Somebody in big brains can
you're
come
right
up with the solution to that.
But it's a bit like saying, let's end poverty. You're absolutely right with your goal or your ideal or your ambition. It's unattainable. And it's beyond our control. We can't even govern our own country, let alone try and govern Sudan or Ethiopia or other countries from whence these people come.
Hey, Nick, can I write? So, but you're saying that the French, for example, wouldn't let us come over to France and do that. But we wouldn't let French people come to the UK and do stuff because it's all... Is it not all about your own control?
No, I know, and although the idea of sort of hurling a net over an outboard motor is quite a clever one, I don't think that works. But my idea of turning them halfway around and taking them back safely could work. Can you imagine how long, how much money, and how fraught it would be to make much of the world from where these people are coming, Afghanistan, Iraq, Sudan, Ethiopia... Your principle is a good one. The execution is impossible. You'll never convert all those countries to places where folk want to stay.
Well, it's more about making them want to stay. We're not asking, like, other people from the world to move there. Just make their
way... Afghanistan for starters. The Taliban's going to resist everything the United Kingdom tried to do there. So you're never going to close that one down. Equally, Sudan, unfortunately, is a rather... irregular place with virtually total lack of the rule of law. So they're not going to allow men, women, Land Rovers, engineers in to build bridges and make the country work. Chris, I'm going to file... Thank you. It's an idea. I just think in reality, it's noble as it is, the intention, it's not going to happen. 8, to 9. Mark's in Camden. Mark, let's talk flags. When you see the flag, whether it's St George or the Union flag, what goes through your mind? Good morning.
Good morning, Nick. I feel a sense of pride. My uncle fought in the Second World War. Grandfather in the First, and my great uncle Ernie. I do feel a sense of pride. I don't think, you know, people saying that a flag can be weaponized. Well, maybe if you bash someone on the head with it.
Well, I don't know, and you don't even have to tell me, but I don't know whether you're Asian or whether you're black. And apparently, if you work in the NHS, you are saying that you do feel that there is some form, that it does offer some form of intimidation.
Well, I think really, then it comes down to people having the sense to educate their children to understand that a flag is not a weapon. And actually, maybe the solution is get behind the flag. If you want to be part of it, you want to, you know, what's wrong with being part of it? Whether you're Chinese, Japanese, or whatever. How about this as a scenario? You get behind the flag of the country that you've chosen to live in. And I don't see that as a problem. If I move to Japan or if I move to anywhere in the world, I wouldn't feel threatened by someone having their flag. And I think we go down, people can start getting a bit willy-nilly, to be honest with you, Nick. And I think people just need to sort of just be a little bit grateful for what they have by being here, rather than sort of like trying to dismantle what is here.
Hear what you say, Mark. You'll be thinking of the people that you know in your family fought. Many will. And of course, in some instances, did not return. Mark, thank you for that. Tim says, we've never been a nation of flag flyers. We fly it for the Olympics or Remembrance Day. Then we fold them neatly away for the next event. The current campaign has been pushed by the racists in an attempt to push an anti-migrant agenda. I think that's a bit all-encompassing, isn't it, Tim? You can't possibly say that every single person who's put up a flag has decided they're in some kind of racist campaign against for anti-migrants. But I hear what you say, except when the Euros come around, then the flags come out again, don't they? Elliot's in Bushy Heath. Elliot, you're on the radio. Good morning.
Good morning. Your question to your previous guest about setting terms and conditions. Nick, I'm a great supporter of yours, but what a question. There should be no terms and conditions. For goodness sake, if you're a Brit and were born here,
that's the point I was trying to make, that people should be able to fly their flag.
Okay, let me finish, please. If you're a Brit and you were born here, or if you're a migrant and you've come here, you're lucky to come here, we're lucky to have been born here, and we fly the flag, we fly our flag. What is the problem? We should be proud of that. We don't need terms and conditions to fly our own emblem. I mean, this country's gone crazy.
A poll of 172 hospital bosses published in a report by the NHS providers found 77% were concerned about discrimination towards NHS staff, which is sometimes emphasised by the use of the flag. I'm quoting directly from the report. Elliot.
Well, they can say that if they want. They would say
we must look at here is that if people working for the NHS who were not born here or are black or they're Asian and they're feeling discomforted, we've got to address that, Elliot. We can't just say, well that's it.
Nick, you're right. I'm not saying that at all. Of course we should. I'm simply saying the most simplest point. If you were born here or if you've come here to work, we're delighted to have you here. Please be proud of the landscape and the environment in which you now reside. If you don't like it, you can go. Well, and part of being proud...
Elliot, just lastly, some people who don't like it work for the NHS. If they all go, we won't have an NHS. So we have got to address this. We need to educate these people to let them
know. I'm not saying they should go.
You did just say they should leave this country. You did actually say it, Elliot. My argument is we need to educate about the flag and say that it is a flag of national unity, not one of discrimination. That's what the flag is all about.
I totally agree with you, and I'm not saying people should go at all. I'm simply saying, look, Nick, it's simple. I was born here. I'm lucky and proud to have been born in a Western democratic country with all our freedoms. People that choose to come here, I'm delighted. They contribute. And they, too, I hope, are proud of being here.
Elliot, thank you. Only finishing to get at least one more voice in. 3 to 9 at the time. Tan in Redbridge. Tan, you're on the radio. What's happened with the flag? Why is it causing this sort of, this level of anger, do you imagine? Good morning.
Hi, Nick. Good morning. I think what a lot of people are missing is like the historical context. Mm. When I say that, I mean, I'm from a South Asian background, right? Mm. And when my grandfather came to this country, there was a lot of, obviously, I don't think I can say the word, but
well, there's a lot of, I imagine, racist comments directed. Well,
exactly, the whole bash.
Yes, okay. If we can, I appreciate that. If we can avoid that sort of language, it would help me enormously.
Yeah. So, and then it comes down to intention, right? Those people that are like when it's Euros, World Cup, like you said, I fly the England flag myself. Mm. But then when it comes to intention, those people that are flying the flag as a way to kind of cordon off areas or kind of...
Do you think that's happening a lot, Tan?
No, it comes down to the individual, right? And I think everyone just needs to look at themselves. If that's their intention, most likely the issues the NHS staff are facing, they're going to face it in other ways. It's not just the flag, right? People that are flying the flag for the wrong reasons and yes. claim to be prideful of the country and love this country, but they're flying the flag for the wrong reasons.
It's how you decide that, because... Am I pretending that every single person who's put up a flag in the recent wave is not racist? No, of course there will be some who've done it. But equally, you can't decide that anyone who puts a flag up is trying to be unhelpful to NHS staff. Tan, thank you. Quick minute to Belfast. That's in Colham in Belfast. You've got a history of flags in that area. Morning.
Morning. Thanks for taking me on the show. Great talking to you. I think it's very pertinent over here. I think in every area, you have Union Jack or you have the tricolour, whether it be the hanging in the area or whether it be on curbs. I think it's every... Well, I can't say it's in every area, but they are now... it's what they're doing now is they're taking the Jewish... they're taking the Palestinian flags, or they're taking the Israel flag as well. And I think it's quite ridiculous. And,
All right, sir. Okay. I think what you say ridiculous is the tension because it's a flag. But, of course, as you rightly say, the Palestinian flag, the Star of David, can incite such emotion. Colin, thank you from Belfast. The music means we have to move on. And coming up after the news, Prince William discussing how he and his wife Kate told their three children that mum had cancer.
We choose to communicate a lot more with our children. Now, that has good things and it's bad things. Sometimes you feel you're oversharing with the children, you probably shouldn't. But most of the time, hiding stuff from them doesn't work.
Plus, back to that Donald Trump demand. Pay up or shut up. $1 billion or a big apology from the BBC. I'll ask you, which should it be? 9 o'clock news is next.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 9 o'clock, a government minister has told LBC the BBC should apologise to Donald Trump if they made an editorial mistake. The US president says he's going to sue the organisation if they don't retract false statements made about him in a Panorama documentary. Alison McGovern told Nick the BBC should invest in its journalism to avoid errors in the future.
If they've made an editorial mistake, then they should apologise. If they've made errors, I think the answer to that is better quality journalism and to invest in that journalism so that we can have the standard of programmes we all want from the BBC.
Former Home Secretary Suella Braverman thinks the row has left the Prime Minister in an impossible position. You can read her piece in full on the LBC app. An independent commission has found the UK's PREVENT programme needs a radical overhaul. It says the current definition of terrorism is too broad and the wider counter-terror strategy is not fit for purpose. 90% of people referred to PREVENT are said to be turned away because they have no obvious ideology. The UK's unemployment rate has risen to the highest level since 2020. The latest data from the Office for National Statistics shows it hit 5% in the 3 months to September. City AM's editor Christian May told Nick businesses are being cautious ahead of the budget.
So these are big structural challenges, and the government would say it's trying to unravel. But the bottom line is that businesses are cautious. They're nervous, their costs have increased, their employment costs have increased, and a lot of people are battening down the hatches in anticipation of the budget in a couple of weeks' time. So we don't expect any great change in employment sentiment among businesses for some time.
Thousands of high street businesses have been raided in a month in a bid to tackle money laundering. The National Crime Agency targeted stores including barbers, vape shops and mini-marts across the UK. It's the largest action of its kind, with more than 920 people arrested. And new figures show many are holding off on spending ahead of Black Friday. The British Retail Consortium says total sales in the UK increased by 1.6% year on year. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 105 points at 98.92. The pound buys $1.32 and €1.14. LBC weather, rain spreading to the north and west of the UK, but staying dry and bright in the south and east. Highs of 16 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Lottie Morley.
How would you describe McCain vibes?
I would reckon it's like a crisp and a chip. If they had a baby, do you know what I mean?
I don't know.
A chip and a crisp.
Combination.
It's got crisp ancestry, but it's a chip.
Like a hot chip crisp combo thingy. Yeah. Pure poetry that was.
McCain vibes. Our chip crisp combo hot snack thingies in a freezer aisle near you.
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation with Nick Ferrari at breakfast.
Good morning, 3 minutes after nine, Tuesday the 11th of November. Honesty is the best policy. Is that the reality when you have to tell your children that you, your wife, your husband, your mum, your dad, your grandparent, whatever it might be, is suffering with cancer? It's what Prince William chose to do, but what are the stories that you will share? Plus to the biggest story of the day, possibly the week, the month, maybe even the year, it will go down as scoop of the year. The inner turmoil within the BBC. And now the deal, of course, from President Trump. Apologise or I'll sue you for $1 billion. Well, here's the Alison McGovern, the Minister for Local Government and Homelessness. What does she think the BBC needs to do?
If they've made an editorial mistake, then they should apologise. And we've just been talking about standard systems, and I think the BBC is probably chock full of policies on what they should do when they make editorial mistakes, so I think they should stick to it.
And I seem to say this every year, if you haven't got your poppy, you've still got time. Get out there, you've got a little under 2 hours, although I'm sure they're still available afterwards. But what do young people make of those, like me, who almost make a religious point of wearing the poppy?
My mum always used to make me wear a poppy, but I'm going to be honest, I have no idea what any of that means.
I would never wear a poppy. I do support the soldiers who fought in World War One, obviously, but I think there's other ways to show support to those people.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
Tough conversation to have here, because it involves loved ones and telling them that you have cancer. And just that word, although every time I speak with cancer specialists, we seem to be gaining, making advances and trying to fight back against cancer, it is still absolutely chilling, isn't it? So let's go back to March of last year, and the moment we first heard the Princess of Wales had cancer, announcing her diagnosis in this video message.
In January, I underwent major abdominal surgery in London, and at the time, it was thought that my condition was non-cancerous. The surgery was successful. However, tests after the operation found cancer had been present. We hope that you'll understand that as a family, we now need some time, space and privacy while I complete my treatment. My work has always brought me a deep sense of joy, and I look forward to being back when I'm able. But for now, I must focus on making a full recovery.
Kate is now in remission, and we wish her nothing, of course, but a full recovery. But William described the experience last year, weeks before the King's own diagnosis, as brutal. Well, William was talking about this yesterday with Brazilian television, and he shared what it was like when they had to impart the news to their children.
We choose to communicate a lot more with our children. Now, that has its good things and its bad things. Sometimes you feel you're oversharing with the children, you probably shouldn't. But most of the time, hiding stuff from them doesn't work. Sometimes helps give them a bigger picture and they can relax more into it rather than be really anxious about what are you hiding from me, what do I not know, why is that happening? There's a lot more questions when there's no answers. But it's always a balancing act. I mean, every parent knows that.
So I've told you before how I lost my dad many years ago to cancer. I've never shared this with you, though. I remember it was the interregnum between Christmas and New Year, or maybe just into the New Year, and it would have been 1982. It had been 43 years ago. And Dad had clearly had a very, very tough Christmas. He wasn't well. But I subsequently learned that Mum and Dad decided not to tell me and my two brothers because they didn't want to ruin Christmas for us, but you could tell the man wasn't well. And then they told us the news. And I remember I was living in a little village in Kent. And I remember walking around the village with tears streaming down my face with my then girlfriend, who was great. She really did do everything she possibly could. Funny enough, she was a nurse as well. And all the Christmas lights were in all the houses and the Christmas trees. And I never felt less celebratory than I did having told my father had cancer. Of course, it's all the positives we're going to fight. That was probably January the 2nd. He died on March the 23rd. So what did he get? He got another couple, 2 and a bit months. And I won't share the moment of the conversation if that's okay, because I probably wouldn't get through it. But it never, ever leaves you. So have you had those conversations? I can still see him in my mind's eye. And he had been physically a strong bloke. Funny enough, he was in the war. There we are. I'll be thinking of him in under 2 hours' time. He served in the army. Tremendous strong bloke. I know this is a mad thing to say, but we had quite a lot of land, so he's always felling trees. He would climb up a tree with a chainsaw going on a piece of rope below him. Okay, so the ladder was so, and then he'd just climb up a tree. I like chainsaws, but I never saw a physically strong man. But not how, of course, he was left after cancer. So how do you impart that? Emma Campbell is a writer and survivor of cancer, living with secondary breast cancer, and I'm delighted to say been in remission for some years. Good to have you on. May I call you Emma? Good morning.
Hi, Nick. How are you?
I'm all right, thanks, Emma. You're a mum. How many children do you have? How old were they when you got your diagnosis, and how did you handle it?
So I'm a mum of four. I've got triplets and an older boy, and the triplets were 6 months old when I was first diagnosed in 2010, and my eldest son was six. So you can imagine, the key thing is it's age dependent. So the babies were oblivious in a way. Thankfully, my six-year-old was running around in Spider-Man costumes, very much in the present, as most six-year-olds are. And for him, it was very much a case of, needing to keep the routine as he knew it, to reassure him and to prepare him for the fact that I was going to lose my hair. But luckily at that age, children are very, very good at being in the now, and I think that changes as they get older. So it really is age dependent, I think.
So the children for William and Kate are now 12, 10 and 7. So Louis, possibly around the same age as your boy. How did your... I hear what you say about the triplets. How did your lad handle it?
I remember the first... So I've had to tell him 3 times that I've got cancer. The first time he was very much in the moment, and my language was very simple, age appropriate. Mummy's got a nasty lump, but the doctors are going to give me lots of strong medicine to make the lump go away. And I remember saying to him, but I might look a little bit silly for a while because I'm going to lose my hair. And it was very much kind of, okay, Mum, what's for dinner? It really was that.
Mm-hmm.
Second time round, he just started secondary school. And again, I think was able to take in a few more facts, but I needed to keep it simple and really reassure him that he could ask me anything, And then when I got my third diagnosis, he was 15. And I think for teenagers, they really want to feel included and that they don't have to be strong for us. I think as they develop, I think they want honesty and space for their own emotion. And I think all the way along at whatever age, it's about reassurance, them knowing it's not their fault and that they're safe and loved and that they can ask any questions.
Emma, how has the language changed over the years? Has it become quite medical? I mean, obviously, I don't want to be rude. I doubt your six-year-old knew what cancer was when he was six, but now he's going to be... Something.
22.
Okay. So now he's... how has the language changed?
Well, I think I'm everyone's in a different position, and I've been so fortunate to be in, long-term remission on ongoing cancer treatment that really allows me to have a relatively normal life. I haven't lost my hair, as you can see. You wouldn't look at me and think, well, she's poorly. And I certainly, with the triplets who are nearly 16, they've grown up with a mum on treatment. That's all they've ever known. But again, they've kind of normalised it because fortunately they haven't had to be told, you know, the worst news. It's so for them, it's much more of a kind of ongoing thing. And then every so often I feel as they get older, as they hit, they're 15 now, nearly 16, it's almost like it hits them. And I see them almost kind of register, I remember recently one of them saying, but is there anything you're not telling us, you know? And he said, no, darling, I'll always tell you. There's nothing I'm hiding from you. Because I think we fill in the gaps, don't we? Whether we're, at whatever age we are, we fill in the gaps if we don't have the information. And we tend to go to the worst possible scenario.
Well, let's conclude. You talk about hiding. This is what Prince William said. Sometimes you feel you're oversharing with the children. You probably shouldn't. But most of the time, hiding stuff from them doesn't work. And so we explain how they feel, why that's happening, giving them other viewpoints as to why they might be feeling like they are. So trying to hide it away with a situation as grave as you were going through wasn't going to work anyway, was it, Emma, in reality?
No, absolutely not. And I think really it's a case of they only need to know what's relevant at that point, you know, and it's very natural to have those questions. But mummy, are you going to die? Or what if the cancer comes back? You know, I get that quite regularly. What if you get ill again? Does that mean you're more likely to die? And all I can repeat are those sort of simple messages of right now, I'm doing really well. Right now, the doctors aren't worried about me, but I'll always explain to you and you can ask me anything. And I think, you know, it's children just need, they look to us, don't they, as the example. But also it's okay for them to see that we're struggling. You know, they've seen me at low points and that's also life as well. That's, I guess, a life lesson of seeing me at low ebb, seeing me come through that, demonstrating a resilience. But just really, you just want them to feel as safe as possible, I guess.
You never stop being a parent, do you? Emma, thank you. Good luck. Be well. Emma Campbell, writer and long-term survivor of cancer. Let's get your stories on the radio. That's what we're about in the morning. Nate is in Paignton. Nate, what are you going to tell me? Good morning.
Good morning, Nick. This is a story very close to my heart. I'm in pretty much exactly the same position as Prince William and Kate, although I'm the person who's I actually have a terminal diagnosis.
Well, we must say, fortunately, Kate is not there, so I'm terribly sorry to hear that. Where is the cancer on your body, Nate?
So I've got a stage 4 bowel cancer, so it's basically in my stomach. Right. At this point. Honestly, Prince William's words of using the word brutal when discussing it with the children is like absolutely spot on. Right. It's possibly the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. Sorry.
Don't worry. You don't have to go on, old chap. Do you want to give it a rest or do you want to carry on a bit?
No, I'm all right.
Might I ask how old the children are and how long ago you were diagnosed?
Yeah, so they're currently 6 and 13. And so when I was originally diagnosed, they were 2 and 9. And the when it became bad and the diagnosis turned into a you're not going to recover from this, they were 4 and 11. So
right.
The conversations were very, very different between the two of them.
What was because the 4-year-old, I imagine, it was difficult for them to get their head around it. Not so the 11-year-old, I would imagine, probably more dialed in, Nate.
Yeah, so the 4-year-old, I mean, it feels like for my youngest that he's just grown up with the idea that daddy's got cancer and that daddy's unwell. And one of the things I've had to try and explain to him is that this is not a normal position for daddy. You know, daddies are not normally unable to walk all the time or, you know, rough and tumble because of operations and things like that. Whereas with the 11-year-old's quite cerebral anyway. He's quite an intelligent young man. And so he does understand. He's taken a very definite denial position, you know, hoping for the best. And I think that's a coping mechanism, and I think it's a perfectly legitimate one. But we're very open and honest with the boys because my biggest concern, because I've had periods where, you know, I was given 12 months to live. I'm sorry, I was given 6 months to live 12 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've been in positions where I genuinely didn't know whether I was going to make it till Christmas.
Right.
And because of that, we've had to, you know, really let the children know what's happening, because my biggest concern was that they would get sideswiped and that they wouldn't know what was happening, and then all of a sudden daddy's gone. And that was my biggest concern. So yeah, we've been as open and honest as we can be with them, obviously without wanting to burden them. We don't want it to make it define their childhood.
But desperately tough for everyone, your wife or partner as well, just everyone involved with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it's it's been 3 years of everything has had to shift. Our whole, we've done the classic, going to Disneyland, and
have you?
I've had periods where I've been well enough to travel, so we've managed to sort of make memories. And like in some ways, and this will sound a bit strange, but I feel like I've been quite lucky, because I could have been hit by a bus 3 years ago.
Well, a lot of people have a heart attack and they don't even get to say goodbye to their children.
Exactly. So I've had somewhat of a, I was living a normal life. I was grinding along, and I had some issues with some depression and things like that. And ironically enough, my depression has gone away it's quite strange, but when you're told you're not going to live very much longer, and obviously I understand this is not everyone's reaction, but my reaction was that I needed to start living, and it's been really hard.
Best wishes to the little ones. Yeah, they are little ones to your children. Nate, thanks for sharing so much. Be well, and I realise the significance of those words. It's 18 after 9. Headlines on LBC. Lottie Morley.
A government minister has told Nick the BBC should apologise to Donald Trump if they made an editorial mistake. An independent commission has found the UK's Prevent programme needs a radical overhaul. And the UK's unemployment rate has risen to its highest level since 2020. LBC weather, rain spreading to the north and west of the UK, staying dry and bright in the south and east with highs of 16 degrees.
LBC Travel, I'm Joanne Webb. Traffic's being held on the Surrey stretch of the M25 clockwise at Junction 7 at the M23. A car's broken down, so it's very busy back to Junction 6 at Godstone. Also on the M25, there are lengthy delays both ways to Junction 24 at Porter's Bar, clockwise after an accident, but all the lanes are open. And anti-clockwise, it's slow for about half an hour because a car broke down earlier, and that's also been recovered. Slow on the A12 southbound to Junction 15 at Margaretting. It's slow from Junction 17 at Howell Green. There's a load of debris across the road. Still no Gatwick Express trains running for the entire line, and severe delays on the Elizabeth line at West Drayton up to Reading after a track problem from earlier.
LBC.
Save the Children is inviting you to the UK's most spectacular Christmas party. That's right, Christmas Jumper Day is back on Thursday the 11th of December, and Save the Children want every school and workplace in the country to get silly and donate for a seriously good cause. It couldn't be easier. Sign up, get your jumpers out, and this December join the millions of people creating lasting change with Save the Children. Sign up now at christmasjumperday.org.
Call Nick Ferrari now, 0345 6060 973. This is LBC.
Buying a home on a holiday park was the retreat you always wanted. But then came unexpected site fee increases. And that was before the dramatic loss in value. If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, you may have been missold. HolidayParkAdviceCentre.co.uk could help you receive thousands in compensation. Text ASSIST to 78900. That's ASSIST to 78900.
How's the business going?
We're busier than ever, but struggling to get the staff we need.
Recruiting can be such a distraction. We gave Job Centre Plus a try, and they've really helped us out.
Really?
Yeah, it was dead easy. We got our own employer advisor, Julie, who helped advertise our jobs, shortlisted candidates for us, and let us interview at the Job Centre. We've hired some great people, and Job Centre Plus really took the hassle out of it, and there was no fee.
Brilliant. That's straight on my to-do list.
Find out more at business.gov.uk/recruit. Eligibility criteria apply.
A Southern train is a place where you can just switch off. Where you have the chance to scroll your feeds as you roll past fields. Or simply relax with a podcast, playlist or power nap. Go with your flow and save with advanced tickets at southernrailway.com. Terms apply.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Call 0345 6060 973.
Back to some very tough conversations. Well, let's go to the news breaking at the moment. This concerns the BBC, and the outgoing Director General of the corporation, Tim Davey, has just arrived and spoken to journalists outside the offices.
Morning, everyone. Good morning. Just want to say a couple of things. I'm here to lead and support the BBC. I'm very, very proud of our journalists in this building. They're doing work, I think, that's incredibly important. I want to thank every one of them. They're doing a wonderful job. Also, everyone across the BBC doing their thing for the UK. And personally, I'm here to lead and support them. The BBC's going to be thriving, and I support everyone on the team. I'm very proud of them. Thank you very much, everyone.
How will you be responding to Mr. Trump's...
And he will apparently be making an address to all the staff at some point later today. We don't have a time speed reading. No, some point today he will be addressing all staff. Of course, this follows Deborah Turness, the outgoing Chief Executive Officer of News, or Head of News, as we probably call them. She addressed all her news staff yesterday. OK, news that we're discussing is how Prince William and his wife Kate decided to break the news to their children. I'll give you their ages, probably take a year off. George is 12, Charlotte 10, Louis 7, so they were probably 11, 9 and 6, give or take, when they had to tell the news that Mummy's got cancer. Joe's in Brent Cross. Joe, your story. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Nick. How are we doing?
Good. What are you going to tell me?
Well, so very similar to Nate and Emma a year ago. Forgive me, sometimes I get emotional
of
here.
Of course. Please, for goodness sake, I'm not surprised.
So, so my wife was experiencing pains in her ribs, and through various tests and things, we were kind of hit with a 2x4 across the head where she was diagnosed with secondary breast cancer.
Right, okay.
I have a 14-year-old son, and I have an 8-year-old daughter. So this was a year ago, so this was last summer. And at first, you kind of go through... it's like, how do we deal with this? And then how do we go about kind of, letting our children know? Again, it's like, I guess we were fortunate in a way because, so my wife's a school teacher.
Right.
So this happened over the summer. So we had like the summer break to kind of be able to, we have a big garden and we would have like a little talk and go and break away. But as the kind of the school year came on and it got darker, we kind of realized we can't have these private conversations anymore. And mm-hmm. not only that, we need to let our children know what's going on with their mom.
How long after the diagnosis was this?
So let's see. So she got diagnosed in July, and we kind of came to the conclusion of, so that break in October, we decided we were going to go away to Bath for a couple of days.
Uh-huh.
And before that, we were going to have a sit-down conversation with them and just, my wife's a school teacher, so she does this really well. We just had like a family meeting and we just said, hey, I don't know if you noticed or not, but mom and dad have been going to the doctor more frequently and we've been on phone calls. And my daughter was just like, oh my God, mom's pregnant. It was a great icebreaker. It was a really great, really great icebreaker.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then we have to come up with the C word, which, at first my daughter was like, and my son's first question was, are you going to lose your hair?
Mm-hmm.
And at that
your
point,
son was 13, right? Just to clarify.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was slightly different, Nick, I gotta be honest with you, it was the biggest weight off our shoulder.
Of course it was.
And not only that, man, I'm sure Nate can deal with this, I'm sure Emma can deal with this, but like with the king and the royal family being so outgoing with what they're going through, it's really helped my
Has
family.
It? Because, Isn't that interesting?
Because we can drive, like, we'll drive along,
yeah.
right? And all of a sudden that conversation will come up. And I'll have a conversation. Before I even told them, I was like, hey, what do you think about cancer? And, it's not just, there are cancers that are treatable. There are cancers that aren't treatable. So it kind of really kind of pulled the wool back a little bit.
It must have been so liberating to share with your children. You no longer had to keep this effectively secret from them.
And again, absolutely. And also, it's just like we have open conversations. Like, there's like, again, it's like, my wife has to go for treatment every month.
we go every month, and, you know, and I go with her, and like we make a day of it. And then after that, like we discuss, like with our kids, oh, mom went for treatment. Mom had some injections, you know.
And how is mom? How is your wife?
Dude, my wife's a superhero.
Yeah, she's doing well.
I mean, I don't know. Dude, Jesus, I've coined a phrase. So we've been living this life, man, for a year and a half now. Yeah. You know, you can wake up from a nightmare. You wake up to a life, man. But my wife has just carried on. It's like, and she's working full time. You know, she's an assistant head.
She's great. Joe, you crack on with her. You be well. Love to the kids. Thank you. John in Cranbrook. John, we're talking about your wife. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. I'm the survivor.
What happened?
So in 2014, my wife was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. She was given 6 months, and our daughter was 4 at the time.
Oh, my goodness.
And it blindsided us all. We made the decision that we were going to include her, our daughter.
Yeah.
And so we started off, you know, with language that was Kerfa cancer. You know, that kind of level of engagement.
Sure.
As it happened, Sophie lived for 7 years.
Ah.
So our language developed over the time. And that was up and down. You know, she went close to death several times. And then a new medication, a new change. I mean, they did fantastic things. But our language changed over that time until she went into the kind of final phase. And she and our daughter had a long talk, because she always promised her that she would tell her when she was dying. And they had this big conversation towards the end of her life.
And what did that conversation cover?
I'm dying. I'm coming close to the end now. They told her that there was nothing else the medication could do. We kept her at home.
Mm-hmm.
She was 11. And on the night Sophie died, she happened to be staying at another house. And the funeral people came in, they cleaned her up and they got her ready. And I took her in to see her body.
Right. Did you ask your daughter, or how did you handle that?
Well, it was a 7-year period, Nick. I mean, it was
right. Okay.
So cancer invades your life.
Mm.
It becomes part of your family in this situation where you're talking about a terminal diagnosis. Mm. So she always knew that she was. So my daughter always knew that my wife's going to die.
Yeah.
You know, at some point we knew. We were constantly told. You know.
And so when we hear William say what he did in Brazil, there's no point trying to hide stuff away because they'll find out. I think you probably support everything he says.
I do. I very much so. I think every family has to choose. You know, how I think they do. There's no should about this. But I agree with William. And I also very much agree with the lady, the author at the beginning.
Her name was Emma.
Yeah. She says, don't let them make stuff up. You know, tell them. Because they, you know, it's not their fault.
Of course it's not. Best wishes to your daughter. Thank you for the story about your wife. You told very, very cogently with such emotion and passion. I'm grateful for your input. You're listening to LBC. It's 9:30 breakfast with me, Nick Ferrari. The headlines now with Lottie Morley.
The BBC's outgoing director general says he supports journalists at the organisation after Donald Trump threatened to sue them. Tim Davies spoke to reporters outside the BBC's London headquarters this morning. The US president wants the corporation to retract statements made about him in a Panorama documentary. Nearly 3,000 businesses have been raided in a month to try to tackle money laundering. The National Crime Agency arrested more than 900 people by targeting stores like barbers and vape shops. And the UK's unemployment rate has risen to the highest level since 2020. The latest data from the Office for National Statistics shows it hit 5% in the 3 months to September. LBC weather, rain spreading to the north and west of the UK throughout the day, staying dry and bright in the south and east with highs of 16 degrees.
LBC.
5 a.m. You wake up with a jolt. After a nightmare that your business was hit by a fraud attack in the night. This is the moment you choose to relax, knowing that Barclaycard Payments is helping to prevent fraud 24/7. So you can go back to counting sheep, not pounds.
That's how we're protecting your business. Barclaycard Payments.
Terms and conditions apply. See barclaycard.co.uk/business for details.
Why am I leaving a gift in my will to Cancer Research UK? When my wife, Sue, was diagnosed with cancer, she was given 6 months to live. But thanks to radiotherapy, we had 10 more years together and she saw our daughter get married. We now know her cancer is hereditary. So I need to do everything I can to help my family, even when I'm not here.
Gifts in Wills fund a third of our work helping us develop life-changing cancer research. Visit cruk.org/giftsinwills. Together we are beating cancer.
Hi, I'm Andrew from New Zealand and Australia travel specialist, Travel Essence. For a tailor-made holiday unlike any other, find your way to us. Our local knowledge saves you time and money, and our experience is your guarantee of quality. We are also members of ABTA and ATOL. Amazing journeys down under start at travelessence.co.uk.
Ferrari at breakfast on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
If I come back to those tough conversations, obviously all best wishes to all the people with whom we're speaking, those who've yet to get through. But we must go back to, with respect to that conversation we're having about Prince William, the bigger story and the moving pieces as regards the BBC. So we have a deadline now set by President Trump. He wants $1 billion. I told you this history of suing. He's done quite well in suing media organisations in the past for allegations or false claims, fake news, whatever you want to call it. He's asking for $1 billion or a full retraction and apology for that panorama. What's happening now is that at some point through the course of the day, Tim Davie, the outgoing Director General, will give an address to all staff. He's just arrived and spoke briefly at the door just to praise his journalists and say that there was nothing really to see here, and he's going in to try and get his arms around them metaphorically and make sure that the great work carries on, similar to what his head of news or chief executive officer of news, Deborah Tennis, said around 24 hours immediately preceding. So the question is a very simple one. Does the BBC fight or apologise and risk a one... Whether he'd get $1 billion is another matter. I think it converts to about £680 million. Pounds. Now, what should he be doing? In the first hour of the show, I spoke with the columnist of The Observer, Will Hutton. Now, he's explained how he fears that in some instances the BBC is almost under threat here, and he thinks the response has been over-exaggerated.
This crisis is engulfing the BBC, and it has the disproportionality of it, I think, is what allows people like me. I mean, I'm a believer in public broadcasting.
But, Mr. Hutton, it's not just this, is it? If you look at the stories run by The Telegraph last week, we see an LGBTQ desk that decides not to do certain stories because they don't fit with the agenda. We see BBC Arabic's coverage of the Middle East. 522 times a contributor is used who called the Jews devils. They have to offer apologies roughly at the rate of 2 a week, and I've not even mentioned Glastonbury. It's not all down to President Trump, Mr. Hutton, is it?
I'm uneasy about that question, Nick. I mean, I'm not, it's a big, big organisation. I'm not sure.
But all the stories I track back, all track back to the news department,
yeah,
Will.
I know.
I've not gone into Greg Wallace's baking or anything.
No, I mean, we've actually seen the Gaza documentary, which Channel 4 chose to run, public service broadcaster. I mean, I think the heart of this is: do you start with kind of it's so kind of broke, it's got to go and be dismantled, and or do you want to fix it? And I want to fix it.
But what is being achieved by Samir Shah, the chairman, who has to issue the decision to apologise or presumably to instruct lawyers to fight it? Why are they waiting? Just as this report was first made known to them in May. What, this is that classic BBC attitude. If we wait long enough, bury our head in the ground, they might all go away. I put some of this to Gordon Rayner, the associate editor of The Telegraph, the journalist behind the scoop that led to the latest developments, and he agreed the BBC should simply apologise to Trump without delay.
I mean, of course he should apologise to President Trump. I
I do not understand why he's dithering. They've already said that they got this wrong. They've already apologised for the fact that they doctored that speech. Why is he saying that they're considering what to do regarding Trump's demands? They just need to apologise to the man. They've done him a terrible disservice. And I'm afraid it's indicative of the way that the BBC has responded to this entire crisis. It was the same last week when I first put that story to them about Trump. They hoped that it would just go away if they said more or less nothing about it. They spent a week saying almost nothing. It's only when they're forced into a corner that they actually start, you know, realizing what they need to do. And let's not forget, you know, Sami Ashan knew about this Panorama documentary in January, and he did nothing about it then either. He, you know, he is a man who is just dithering and delaying again.
The government view, Minister for Local Government and Homelessness, Alison McGovern, told me,
if they've made an editorial mistake, then they should apologise. And we've just been talking about standard systems, and I think the BBC is probably chock full of policies on what they should do when they make editorial mistakes, so I think they should stick to it. And more broadly, Nick, I think if they've made errors, I think the answer to that is better quality journalism and to invest in that journalism so that we can have the standard of programmes we all want from the BBC.
Do you think their journalistic standards are slipping a little bit, Minister?
I think on the whole, not, because if you look at the levels of trust people have in the BBC, it's extraordinarily high. I think the BBC are in a unique place. They can bring stories from my constituency in Birkenhead, and they deal with massive global issues too. And they have this incredibly high level of trust. The thing that I would ask of them as a politician, you know, I won't always like the questions I'm asked by any journalist, but the thing I would ask of them is invest in that proper journalism. And if you've made mistakes, say sorry.
And here's a little of what you told me in the first hour, starting with David in Walthamstow.
Certainly he's got to say sorry, because it's two of its executives have resigned, so that's already saying sorry. But if Britain loses its state broadcaster, we as a nation will lose that global soft power. The UK, you know, we don't have much left to be proud of in that respect, but the BBC brought into line is definitely worth fighting for.
Seamus in Wellington.
There's a lot of questions I'd like to ask. Why was it sat on for 6 months? What is actually going on at the Arab desk and the Middle East desk? How does an organisation that prides itself on fact-checking information, how on earth could this happen? It was a malicious doctoring of information.
Austin and Norbury.
I'm just feeling there needs to be a bit of balance in the BBC debate. Yes, they need to apologise, but I don't understand Donald Trump wanting to sue us for billions. It's Great Britain, not America, and he's the master of fake news. He's created mayhem.
Sue's in Cheam. Sue, what would your advice be to the BBC, and can you figure out why they're waiting?
I haven't got a clue, darling. But good morning, anyway.
Hello, honey.
Hello. Well, to be quite honest, it would be prudent for them to apologise.
Yes.
And then I believe they should play his speech in full, and then once his speech is finished, they should list, as they do quite solemnly, a list of the people who died that day, and as it's alleged that he didn't call off his supporters, who it's alleged were the people who attacked the White House, or not the White House, or
the Capitol.
Congress.
Yeah, the Capitol.
Then he, you know, that should be put out there. But Mike Pence, is it Mike Pence? He had to flee for his life.
They were going to string him up.
So, you know, it could have been a lot worse if he hadn't escaped. He might be dead now, but I just think they should face it, as I say, apologise, because it's just to keep everything nice, and then show the whole thing and let the people judge.
You don't think that's rather inflammatory and that's just going to excite President Trump into more action?
Well, I mean,
Can they not just accept this was a very, very bad day at the office, a shocking day at the office? Get the apology out there, try and move on with your life, get a new news boss, get a new overall boss, and just rebuild?
Well, you see, my, you know, let's have it easy side says, yeah, go on then. But the other side says, you know, there's a principle here. Mm. And I just think when I witnessed what he did say from that speech, I was absolutely shocked and horrified that was happening into our precious America, who we all feel very close to. Well, not all of us, I can't speak for everybody, very close to. And I just thought, this should not be happening in America at this, in this particular time. You know, 2021, wasn't it, that's...
Yeah, it's you're right, it shouldn't be happening, but of course things do happen. Sue, thank you for that. I'm finishing so that I can feature some of the many, many texts and emails that have come in on this. Anthony says, if the BBC disappeared, it wouldn't change anything in my life. I'm told I have to pay something I don't watch. It needs to change to a subscription service. I want to make it plain, I'm not suggesting you close down the whole of the BBC. We were talking last week about how great programmes such as Traitors are. I don't watch Strictly Come Dancing, but I know many, many of you do, and I would imagine it's starting to near the end. Where are we? Yeah, mid-November. It must be starting to end. Get close to the end of this series, and we have to be aware that it can make great shows like that. Mike in Wolverhampton. I think you've missed the point here, Mike. Siding with a petty and thin-skinned foreign leader over our own BBC is truly disgusting and unpatriotic. Mike, if it was only the Donald Trump story, I'm pretty certain Tim Davey would stay in post. But you cannot continue to preside over an organisation that gets it wrong time after time after time, whether it's Glastonbury, whether it's paying your paedophile newsreader money when he was already suspended, money which you've never been able to get back, whether it's running the Arabic service, the BBC Arabic service, which can feature someone who called Jews devils 522 times and has to issue roughly 2 apologies every week. That, by the way, was run by Jonathan Munro, who is, in some quarters, tipped to be the next head of news. He was the one who offered Martin Bashir his job back after he duped the Princess of Wales. He also arranged for helicopters to be flown around Cliff Richard's apartment. So if that's the new look, it's not going to get much better, is it, when you think about it? Now let's talk about the royal family and the news from Brazil that William and Kate decided to tell their 3 very young children that Mum had cancer. Have you had a conversation like that? Sarah's in Wandsworth. Sarah, what happened with you? Good morning. Sarah, can you hear me? No, Sarah. Sarah's gone, so instead we'll go to the emails on this. This comes in from John. This is a very difficult conversation, but a bit like you, Nick, I remember the circumstances in which I heard the news. I think the Royals are absolutely right to do what they do. It's important with there is such honesty. Lenny in Tower Hill agrees. It's fantastic to see the Royal family taking such a lead here. We're lucky to have Charles, we're lucky to have William, and indeed, we're even lucky to have those children. Yes, I sense it will probably carry on. I'll try again. I'm told Sarah in Wandsworth, you're there, Sarah?
Hi, Nick. Sorry about that. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. You're on the radio. I'm good. What are you going to tell me, Sarah?
So the first time that my mum told my sister and I that she had cancer, we were in primary school. So I was in primary school. My sister was heading into secondary school.
Okay.
I don't quite remember that conversation because I was quite young then. I'm now 27. We heard that she was going to be okay, that she had breast cancer, that they're going to sort this out. They caught it early. She was then in remission for a very long time. We then heard a few years ago that she had ovarian cancer and they did not catch this in time and that she had a terminal diagnosis. The second conversation, I was much older, around maybe 25 or 24. I didn't quite know how to handle this, and I wanted to solve everything. I wanted to try and make her feel well, make her feel better, but it was out of my hands, of course. But
yeah, of course.
I am of the mind that you have to be honest with your kids, and it's a very hard conversation. I've had it twice now. My mum passed 2 years ago.
You've had it twice in that...
I've had the conversation with my mum twice.
I see when she first told you. I see what you're saying. Yeah. What do you remember most significantly about that conversation?
So the last conversation was my mum telling me, so we had a conversation with the doctors, so she was in the hospital and she wanted the nurses and the doctors to her oncologist to speak to us as opposed to her saying it, because I think at this point she was very much defeated and she was keeping this away from us for as long as possible the second time around. The doctors were explaining to us that they were going to put her through chemo, that they had treatments that she could do, but it was very unlikely that she would live for another 2, 3, 4 years, and this is something that they needed to just tell us.
What do you remember about your emotions at this time?
Oh, Nick, I'm not going to get emotional. It's tough because my mum was my best friend, and I didn't know how to handle it, but at the same time, I knew I needed to be strong for her because she was always strong for us. And I wanted to put up a brave face. I wanted to make sure that everything was okay, that she was comfortable.
Yes.
She then had, I think it's called palliative care.
Yes,
at
it
home.
Is called palliative
so,
care.
So, yeah, she had carers come to the house. I also took on that role to look after her. So there was a load of emotions at every single stage after we found out.
Lastly, with hindsight being 20/20 vision, do you think everybody did the right thing at the time? The way your mum dealt with it, the way you dealt with it, was probably such trying circumstances, and there is no set script. Do you think roughly you got it about right?
110%.
Good to hear. Best wishes to you. Tough conversation for you. Your mum would have been proud. We'll stay with us, and we will be reminding you of the significance of course, Remembrance Day today, the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. We're looking at that as well. But it's 9:46, LBC News headlines then, Lottie Morley.
The BBC's outgoing Director General Tim Davey says he still supports the company's journalists after Donald Trump threatened to sue. Nearly 3,000 businesses have been raided in a month to try to tackle money laundering. And the UK's unemployment rate has risen to its highest level since 2020. LBC weather, rain spreading to the north and west of the UK, staying dry and bright in the south and east though, with highs of 16.
LBC Travel, I'm Joanne. We're very busy on the Surrey stretch of the M25 clockwise at Junction 6 at Godston. It was after a car broke down earlier. In Tunbridge on the A21, the Tunbridge bypass southbound, the exit slip road at Junction 26 to the Vauxhall roundabout stays closed, and that's because of the emergency repair works. No Gatwick Express service is running at all. It's all down to this major signal failure at Purley, which also means that Thameslink services are severely disrupted as well. And Southern, they can't stop at Purley as a result, and the rest of their service to and from Victoria and London Bridge are delayed. London Northwestern trains are running between Watford Junction and St Albans Abbey, and there are minor delays on the underground for the Bakerloo, Circle and District lines.
Coming up at 10 on LBC, James O'Brien.
Will you mourn the passing of the two-child benefit cap, and why precisely some flags are obviously frightening?
James O'Brien at 10. Listen on our free Global Player app or our new LBC app.
Hey Sainsbury's, off to my neighbour's Christmas do later. Got any gift ideas?
How about our Taste the Difference chocolate chip shortbread tin, deliciously Moorish all-butter biscuits in a bougie box? Or give them a treat for the eyes and the taste buds with our indulgent Taste the Difference cherry and amaretto panettone. What do you think?
I think I'd rather keep them for myself.
Looking for a tasty festive gift? Ask Sainsbury's. Sainsbury's, good food for all of us.
Subject to availability, available in selected supermarkets and online.
Call Nick Ferrari now. 0345 6060 973. LBC.
How's the business going?
We're busier than ever, but struggling to get the staff we need.
Oh, recruiting can be such a distraction. We gave Job Centre Plus a try, and they've really helped us out.
Really?
Yeah, it was dead easy. We got our own employer advisor, Julie, who helped advertise our jobs, shortlisted candidates for us, and let us interview at the Job Centre. We've hired some great people, and Job Centre Plus really took the hassle out of it, and there was no fee.
Brilliant. That's straight on my to-do list.
Find out more at business.gov.uk/recruit. Eligibility criteria apply.
Experience. It's knowing when something is worth waiting for and when it isn't. That's why Saga Health Insurance offers unlimited GP appointments whenever you need them. With a choice of flexible plans, prompt tests and treatment, your health is taken care of. And right now, get 3 months free. Search Saga Health Insurance for a quote today. New customers starting a policy before the 27th of November. Pay by monthly direct debit for the first year. Terms and conditions apply. Over 50s only.
Train to Cambridge and then all aboard the paddleboards. A little bit different. Should be fun. Or wobbly. Or wet.
The wetsuit's a good look on you, Steve.
Oh, actually, this is very relaxed.
George is up the river cam without a paddle.
Train home. That was such a laugh. I think I might even have a new hobby. Download the Thameslink Railway app to book tickets and save a third off group travel on off-peak journeys. Thameslink Railway, where every stop is a story.
Yep, I'm still dancing. And there's still time to get in tonight's EuroMillions draw. So turn up that dial. The EuroMillions jackpot is £95 million. Go on, play on app.
Estimated jackpot. Account terms, rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Call 0345 6060 973.
The toughest conversation of all? Well, it's not easy to tell your children, is it, that mum or dad has cancer? Matt says, I had to tell my grown-up children, 20 and 22, I had cancer 2 years ago. Mine is a very rare ocular melanoma, which doesn't have a treatment, let alone a cure. I've had to self-fund private treatment. It's still a very difficult conversation for us all. Alastair in Stourbridge, I appreciate the right to privacy, and it's really no one else's business. I feel that having been open about the diagnoses of cancer, it would be of help to other patients if the King and Princess of Wales actually said the form of cancer they've been treated for. They've both been tight-lipped. As a cancer survivor, having been treated at the Royal Marsden in Chelsea, I know it's reassuring to speak to others with the same cancer you have and take hope from their recovery. I think that's very fair, Alastair. It's not for any of us, by the way, to tell them what they should do, but I can sense it would be of enormous help. Matt says, my mum died 4 days before Christmas. Four days before Christmas last year. This is a tough time for you. Every time you see the trees go up and everything. After a short battle with cancer, telling my kids that Nanny had died was the worst experience of my life, personally, but I found kids are resilient and more understanding than we believed. We were honest with them from the beginning, so that if the worst thing happened, it wasn't a sudden shock. All right, Adam's in Aldershot. You want to come at this a slightly different way, I read. In what way is that, Adam? Good morning.
Good morning. Well, I was told, me and my brother and sister were all told when I was 15 that mum had cancer after Christmas. Mm-hmm. But as I've gotten older, I think I've realised that she probably had cancer a month before because she started getting a pain in her shoulder. But she didn't want it. She didn't want to, like, tell us until after Christmas, so as children we could enjoy Christmas as a family.
That's what my father
and
did.
I definitely think it's a timing, especially for myself.
Are you of the opinion that they should have told you as soon as they knew now then, Adam?
No, I believe that they did the right thing, and we did celebrate the last Christmas without the looming of, well, my mum and dad would have known, but as children, we enjoyed the last Christmas as a family.
How long ago was that?
It was a while ago. I was 15, and I'm 34 now.
Looking back, though, they probably did the right thing. Otherwise, what your memories are of as good a Christmas. All right, your mum was ill, you realise now, but I'm sure they rallied and put on as best a show as they could for the holiday period, for the Christmas period for you all.
Yeah, it was, as I remember, the last and best Christmas that we had as a family. Because my mum loved Christmas. It was, we had always had two trees. one was a holy tree, and the other one was the colourful Christmas tree. And
those are great memories to have. Adam, thank you for that. If we're talking memories, the whole nation in an hour and a bit should come to a halt and remember the extraordinary sacrifice that's been given by military personnel and their families down the years. You've only got a bit of time to buy a poppy beforehand. You can always buy one afterwards. But I'm reading sales aren't going that well. At least that's what the papers are saying. Kems is in Folkestone in Kent. You sell poppies, do you? Good morning to you.
Morning, Nick. Hope you're well.
Yeah, I'm good. What about you, sir? How's it been this year?
Quiet. It's every year it gets worse, I'm afraid. I've been collecting poppies for years, since I've been in the army. Selling poppies. And every year you tend to find that there's less people buying them. The people do not understand what they're for. I have people sort of tell me that it supports wars, which is the complete opposite. Gracious. It's to remember everybody that's been affected by all wars. And it's frustrating. I've had a 17-year-old last year asking why we were selling flowers, and it turns out his uncle was in the army.
That's extraordinary.
it's all about the education. And I think, so I've been helped by the British Legion. I was medically discharged from the army. They helped me with legal representation. I had to take the army to tribunal. And so they paid for that. I was lucky enough to be part of the Team UK for the Invictus Games this year.
Well done, sir.
Yep. And so, thank you. British Legion Recovery support, they fund us and they manage us. So what's helpful for me is so I can actually explain to people where the money goes.
Let me ask you this. Okay, so fewer people buying poppies, but are they each person giving more than they did last year? Or do you think takings are down as well?
Take-ins are definitely down. And they said it is about the education, because I do have people come in and they'll put £10 in the pot, but they don't want a poppy.
Right.
Which is, this is fair enough. They are, the important part is supporting the charity. Supporting the charity. But what I always say to them is, you know, if you don't wear a poppy, other people don't see the poppy and they won't get one. So, you know, it's that visual representation, because unfortunately we don't have, well, not unfortunately, but we don't have wars and things are on the news every day. So it's not in people's minds. So I think we are very visual.
And how many years, lastly, have you done this, Kemsley?
Oh, it's probably coming on 20-odd years now.
Wow. And does it decline bit by bit by bit each year?
Yes, but it's happening more rapidly now. Each year does dwindle, but it's happening a lot in bigger sort of numbers now, unfortunately. And it's the volunteers as well. We need volunteers to help do the poppies as well.
Thank you for what you've done. Thank you for your service as well. I'm sorry, obviously, the terms of your discharge, but it's funny, Kemsley, and well done for doing it yet again all these years, because in little over an hour, the nation will fall silent for 2 years to remember those who lost their lives and those, of course, who came back injured. And as I was just talking with Kemsley there, we wear a poppy, but I had been thinking, what about young people? Will this one day effectively just fade from national conscience? Do they actually understand what a poppy means? So I asked my LBC colleague Helen Hodnott to go to the streets of central London specifically to target young people and to find out.
My mum always made me wear a poppy, but I'm going to be honest, I have no idea what any of that means.
Out on the streets of central London, I'm on the hunt for young people wearing poppies.
OK, so you are 25 and you are wearing your poppy on your lapel. Why is it that you wear one?
It's just to respect those that have fought for our country and the ones that have fallen for us so we can have the days that we are living today.
But for the most part, it's a task that's easier said than done.
I would never wear a poppy. I do support the soldiers who fought in World War One, obviously, but I think there's other ways to show support to those people, like making sure veterans aren't homeless on the streets.
Thoughts on the poppy?
I think they're sweet. I think it's nice. I used to wear one when I was in school. I used to always get one, have it on my blazer.
Would you wear one now?
Off my own accord, probably not, just because I don't really know anything about it.
My gran always wore one, so she'd buy me one if we were out at the shops, and I don't wear one currently.
And what do you think it represents?
I thought for the people who died in the war, but I could be so wrong.
I think the symbolisation of a poppy is important because many people died in the First and Second World War. I feel like it's become a bit of a weapon.
Would you wear one?
No.
How might you then go about honouring fallen soldiers who died fighting for the country?
I think the minute silence, that's the most important thing, so you're taking a moment to reflect.
What do you think the poppy represents?
I feel like it represents like British people.
You wore one growing up. Would you wear one now?
I would wear one now. I think if one was given to me, I would wear one.
Yeah, I would, but I don't really have much people around me that wear them. I guess it just reminds me of school.
LBC's Helen Hodnott reporting. And remember, of course, it's not just that 2 minute silence. It's for not just the First and Second World War. It's the Falklands. It's Afghanistan. It's all the conflicts. I'm done. If you missed any of today's show, listen back on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app, where you can stay up to date with all the latest news and opinion, put your news categories in the order you want, pause and rewind live radio, and listen to a range of podcasts. Download the all new official LBC app for free from your app store now. I'll be with you again tomorrow morning from 7. James O'Brien's the other side of the news. Talk to you again from 7. Meanwhile, stay safe.
Thank you, Nick. The time is approaching 10 o'clock, and I'm still in that weird zone that I described to you yesterday. I am, for the first time in my life, never mind my career as an alleged broadcaster and chronicler of current affairs, I am genuinely engaged by the looming budget. We covered the income tax angle yesterday, and today it's the child benefit cap, the two child benefit cap. The idea that if you have more than two children and fall upon hard times, you get no help from the state, because we all hate so much the people who have more than two children and haven't fallen on hard times. They have elected as a lifestyle choice to live in them. Apparently, it is unpopular with Labour MPs, the cap, but popular with voters. Really?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, the BBC's outgoing director general insists he's very proud of journalists at the organisation. Tim Davies spoke as he arrived at the corporation's central London headquarters, where he's due to address staff in an online meeting. He didn't mention the threat of a billion-dollar lawsuit by Donald Trump, though, over the editing of a Panorama documentary.
I'm very, very proud of our journalists in this building. They're doing work, I think, that's incredibly important. I want to thank every one of them. They're doing a wonderful job. Also, everyone across the BBC doing their thing for the UK. The BBC's going to be thriving, and I support every one of the team. I'm very proud of them.
Prince William is appearing in a video in school assemblies across the country this morning to tell young people about the importance of the poppy. He's speaking to mark Armistice Day, marking the end of the First World War. Army veteran Tim Penny told LBC it's always an emotional time for him.
Obviously, remember those who paid the ultimate sacrifice, those who've been injured in service, but also those whose lives have changed considerably as a result of their service.
We'll be observing the silence at 11 o'clock here on LBC. Police investigating comments made on stage during Bob Villain's set at Glastonbury Festival say they've interviewed a man under caution. Officers say he intended voluntarily yesterday afternoon. There are calls for the UK's Prevent programme to get a radical overhaul. An independent commission has found the definition of terror is too wide and the programme is not fit for purpose. Thousands of barbershops and vape stores have been raided in a crackdown on money laundering. The National Crime Agency says more than 900 people have been arrested in a month in the biggest operation of its kind. And it's emerged a learner driver has failed their theory test 128 times. DVSA figures also reveal two people have taken their practical test 37 times without passing. That would have likely costed more than £2,000 each. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 91 points at 98.78. The pound buys $1.32 and a euro 14. LBC weather, rain spreading to the north and west of the UK, but staying dry and bright in the south and east. Highs of 16 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Lottie Morley.
Hey Sainsbury's, any recommendations for a cosy Sunday lunch that's easy on the wallet?
How about a whole leg of lamb? Half price with Nectar. Now that's a treat that'll really make your Sunday.
Roast lamb. Comforting, delicious and perfect for leftovers.
Want to save big on your winter roast? Ask Sainsbury's. Sainsbury's, good food for all of us.
Buy Sainsbury's whole leg of lamb offer ends 18th of November. 18 plus, Nectar required. Available in store and online excluding locals. Subject to availability, T&Cs apply.
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Three minutes after 10 is the time, and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. I don't really like hyperbole, except when I do. It's also one of those words. I always wonder, does it mean something ever so slightly different to what we generally use it to mean? But no, I don't think it does. It means sort of like overblown and exaggerated, doesn't it? Hyperbole. It's the best. This is the best radio programme in history. Well, actually, that's probably not hyperbole. But, okay, how about if you were to talk about this radio programme potentially reaches a billion. How many people are there in the world, Keith? Do we know what the population of the world is off the top of our heads? A rough idea? Lots. This radio programme potentially reaches billions of people. Is that hyperbole? I think it probably is. It's true. Potentially, because you can listen on the internet pretty much wherever you are in the world. But it's obviously hyperbole. It's an exaggeration. And I don't normally like hyperbole. I think it's the kind of the 8.1 billion. It won't be quite that many because some people haven't got the internet. Some people are in North Korea. But anyway, 6 or 7 billion minimum, 6 or 7 billion potentially people. Alert the advertising department. Listening could be listening to this programme right now. And we only count the ones who are listening on the radio. But I don't like hyperbole. I generally don't like hyperbole, but I do feel, and I don't know whether it's a sign of me getting old. First time in my life recently, I've caught myself thinking about, what I'm going to leave to my children. And it focuses the mind on financial matters in ways that my mind has never been focused before. I am an idiot, as you know, in so many ways. But on matters like this, when I was a newspaper journalist, I was so grateful to have the job that I often didn't bother doing my expenses. I sort of paid
for entertainment. I mean, some journalists live by their expenses. Famously, when I did my first ever shifts on the London Evening Standard, there was a bloke reputed to have put his son through Eton on expenses because they were so generous back in the day. You could just turn up at the cashier's office in the morning without even producing receipts and tell them how much you'd spent the night before on entertaining the great and the good. And there was so much money sloshing around the corridors. That, no, that might be apocryphal, but certainly we were very excited by it when we started out in the business. But I've never really got my hand. I've got mates who are, right, they could tell you now how much their shares have performed today, up to almost the hour. And obviously, some people had pensions when they were seven. But it's only really when I started looking at the world and what it will look like when I'm not in it anymore, for my children, for my girls, that I've started thinking a little bit more about fiscal matters. And I don't think I've become more selfish. But I will not be surprised if I do in the coming years. As the grim reaper edges ever closer, the possibility of me becoming a little bit more self-interested when it comes to the economy, when it comes to personal finances, perhaps increases. And I mention all of that because I'm genuinely surprised to discover how interested I am in the coming budget. And the reason why I keep wanging on about hyperbole, is because I think there is an awful lot resting on it, but not quite as much as hyperbole would allow. So hyperbole would tell us that this is make or break for Rachel Reeves. This will decide whether or not Labour goes into the next election with its head held high. This may even be the difference between Keir Starmer making it to the next election and not, or Rachel Reeves being Chancellor this time next year and not. Some of which may be true, some of which may not be true, none of which is either provable or copper bottomed. But the two child benefit cap is quite bizarrely, for something that is so provocative, for something that inspires such strong feelings, it is not something that we've talked about a lot on the programme. Partly because there's quite a bit of confusion surrounding what it is, and that is confusion that I hope I don't add to this morning. But I acknowledge that if history is anything to go by, then it's perfectly possible that I will add to it. The report this morning is that come the budget on the 26th of November, Rachel Reeves will get rid of it. That she will, or at least, at the very least, could, is the reporting today, abolish the controversial policy. We know this because she has said that she doesn't think it's right that children are, quote, penalised, end quote, for being part of large families. She also does that thing that is very difficult to properly measure. When you talk about intangible long-term benefits, including financial ones that will offset very tangible short-term losses. So it costs a lot of money, potentially billions of pounds to do this. But she talks about the costs to our economy in allowing child poverty to go unchecked. This story, and you may not think it at first glance, it cuts in many ways to the very heart of politics, actually, and politics is an intrinsically personal thing. One of the great sadnesses of the current era and the madness and the promotion of lies and liars is that people are turning away from the news and people are turning away from proper politics that is complicated and difficult and falling instead into the laps of people who pretend that it's simple and people who lie. And people who mislead and exaggerate and embellish and engage daily in hyperbole. Because you can't do this stuff in cartoon form. You can't do this stuff simplistically. If you were to measure the impacts of child poverty, you'd be looking at 40-year-olds. You'd be looking at 50-year-olds. You'd be wondering how much of where they have ended up is attributable to where they started. And you'd also be wondering how much difference would have been made by